You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. I appreciate that you all made it despite yet another weather-delayed, weather-frustrating day in Washington. I'm ready for global warming myself. The Hutchins Center's mission is to improve the quality of fiscal and monetary policy and public understanding of it. And today's discussion is very much in furtherance of those aims. I want to emphasize that there is no Hutchins Center or Brookings position on these issues. We don't necessarily agree with what the papers we've commissioned have to say. In fact, we don't even always agree with, among ourselves here in Brookings, and that's very much in the spirit of open and honest inquiry. We're very grateful to Glenn Hutchins, who is the benefactor of the Hutchins Center and who'll be here later. Glenn is a model donor. He has been very supportive of us and given us a lot of advice, but is not involved in choosing the topics we discuss or the people who discuss them. And that's important because Glenn happens to be on the board of the New York Fed, and I don't want anybody to think that he had any influence over this. And after you hear Peter Conte Brown, you'll know that he didn't. The subject today of the Federal Reserve accountability and governance is particularly important. It's got a lot of prominence lately. Partly that's because of the nature of the Fed, an institution of enormous economic power given goals by Congress, and then designed to be independent of elected politicians in pursuing those goals. But I think that in recent days, some of the discussion has been untethered by facts, infused with partisan venom, and demeaning to the public servants who work diligently in pursuit of the statutory mandates of the Federal Reserve Act. And we will not participate in that kind of discussion. But the Federal Reserve Act is not perfect. Fed officials are not divine. Neither are members of Congress. And an essential complement to having an independent central bank is that it must be accountable to the elected leadership of the nation and to the public at large. And we see today's discussion is very much in that spirit. We're going to ask some questions, perhaps answer a few, about the Federal Reserve Act itself, about the governance of the Fed, about the nature of independence, given the Fed's expanded mandate to avoid financial instability, about the relationship between Congress and the Fed, about whether there are better ways to hold the Fed accountable, about whether there are better ways that Congress could do its job. And we will do that with reason, with evidence, and with civility. Now, I want to explain to you a little bit about the order of our program, which is weather impaired. We're going to begin with a presentation by Peter Conte Brown, who I'll introduce in a moment, followed by a response from Charlie Plosser, who's enjoying the first day of his retirement as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. And his wife wouldn't let him stay in the house, so he came down here. Our second paper is by Viral Acharya at NYU, who didn't make it this morning, so he'll be participating by phone, as will his discussant, Jeremy Stein, who snowed in Boston. We've decided not to do any more events in February. And after that, we'll have a panel discussion with Ben Bernanke, Sarah Binder, Barney Frank, and Ruth Porat. Three of the four of them are here, and Barney, fortunately, is coming from Atlanta, not from Boston, so he will be here shortly. So we're going to begin with Peter Conte Brown, who is a lawyer, a PhD student in economic history at Princeton, and will, as of July 1st, be an assistant professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. We're very pleased to have him discuss the Federal Reserve Act, governance of the regional Fed banks. Peter, here you are. Why don't you come up?
Well, thank you for that introduction. It's an honor to be here to speak today with so many leaders in the intellectual and practical world of central banking. When I sent today's program to a good friend of mine, he wrote back by quoting Sesame Street, "One of these things is not like the others. One of these things just isn't the same." You probably had the same reaction when you opened your program. I certainly did. So I want to thank my warmest thanks to David Wessel and Cary Grannis and others at Brookings for the honor to be here and participate. Now, to answer my friend's question on the Sesame Street joke, in addition to having a much lower profile than than the other presenters today, I'm also different in that I'm a legal scholar and a financial historian, and so I look at these questions of central banking governance, accountability, and independence from a slightly different methodological approach than the macroeconomists who dominate the field. I think those differences methodologically are useful, and I hope to persuade you of that too as we discuss some of the history and norms of that we'll be discussing today. So, does anyone feel like the Fed's out to get us? So asked Senator Ron Paul recently to a group of presidential vetters in Iowa. The question is part of his most recent campaign to subject the Fed to a public congressional audit. There's much that's criticized about this proposal, not least the fact that the usual vocabulary of balance sheets and assets and profits and leverage are useful at best metaphorically only when we're talking about the Fed. And given, too, that the Fed is already subject to an annual audit, it's very easy to dismiss this proposal and the impulse behind it as the product of so much confusion. So it has been dismissed, frankly. Here's Richard Fisher, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, who in their right mind would ask the Congress of the United States can't cobble together a fiscal policy to assume control of monetary policy. Well, the answer to President Fisher's question is, well, a lot of people. And this isn't just a right-wing conspiracy. Audit the Fed began on the populist left. And today, critics on the left and right are profoundly uncomfortable with that regard as the combination of the Fed's extraordinary power and utter opacity. So audit the Fed and related proposals tap into a very old, still very salient impulse that we want economic prosperity and financial stability, but still want to participate in the formulation of the policies that provide those. Now, as long as there has been a United States, we've had this debate. I'm noting the irony of having Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson on the face of Federal Reserve notes here as they square off in fact and intellectually against Alexander Hamilton. Now, the financial crisis and the post-crisis monetary response have only exacerbated these perennial debates. As a consequence, there's been no shortage of discussion during and unceasingly since the crisis about how to reform the Fed. And most of these discussions, though, have to do with reforming the Fed's functions. That is, changing the way it lends money in an emergency, how it determines which financial institutions are systemically important, and on and on and on. Audit the Fed is just one of them. There's Taylor Rule, Durbin Amendment, Volcker Rule, Liquidity Coverage Ratio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I want to talk about today, though, is the Fed's structure and its governance, the topic of today's conference. And it raises a different question, not what should the Fed do, but who is the Fed? Public and scholarly attention on the Fed usually focus on a monolithic it, and often, in fact, a personal he or she. In fact, the standard grammatical practice I'm following today, and everybody will, is to refer to the Federal Reserve as though it were a proper noun. This is grammatically incorrect. The Federal Reserve is a compound adjective. It modifies other nouns, like Federal Reserve banks and Federal Reserve notes. There's a Federal Reserve board historically. And taken together, a Federal Reserve system created by the Federal Reserve Act. There's no Federal Reserve by itself. And this question is actually more than just a pedantic grammatical point. It stresses that the Federal Reserve system is, in fact, an ecosystem of institutional actors and individuals with different kinds of incentives and layers upon layers of governance. The problem with this kind of governance opacity, as you see here in the slightly dated pre-Dodd-Frank chart, is that when people feel a reflexive desire to understand, even criticize, the Federal Reserve, they're not exactly sure to whom they should point. This is why all debates end up spiraling very quickly into first principles about the gold standard, the coinage clause of the U.S. Constitution, the democratic virtues of Thomas Jefferson, or the venal tyrannies of Alexander Hamilton, and yes, also about audit the Fed. I've written a book. It's called The Power and Independence of Federal Reserve, and it takes up the largely descriptive questions of what is this ecosystem. Today, though, I want to talk about a specific question, both historical and legal, about the nature of this governance system and whether it's operating the way that we would want it to operate. As you'd note from the disclaimer that David gave, I don't think it's operating the way that we should want, and have a few different proposals in what we should do to fix it. So in its place, in place of this complicated governance structure, I would recommend extending public accountability in a way that protects the essential buffer between central banking functions and the day-to-day of electoral politics, but that still gives us better understanding and access to the personnel, the individuals who are pulling these levers of power. The proposals, just to give you, to front load things a little, the different proposals that I'll float is, number one, subjecting all the Reserve Bank presidents, there are 12 of them, to the Constitutional Appointments Clause process, which means the U.S. president nominates, the Senate confirms. Alternatively, selecting just one of them, the New York Fed's president, and subjecting him or her to that same process. And the third, I like both of these, but the third I like the best would be turning the Reserve Bank presidents into branches of the Board of Governors, effectively giving spirit to the letter of one of the most profound amendments to the Federal Reserve Act, which occurred during the New Deal in 1935. Now, first, we need a little bit of history. In the years following the panic of 1907, one of the largest financial panics that we had had in our history, there was a great debate in this country about banking. Now, contrary to popular misconceptions, this wasn't a slapdash, crisis-driven, Congress responding to populist pressure kind of debate. The panic of 1907 happened in, 1907. And the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 happened, I don't mean to pick up the suspense, but 1913. So there were 6 years between these two key events, 6 years, two presidential elections, three congressional elections. In the 6 years between, there was a very thorough international quest to understand our banking system and other banking systems, and to understand what kind of system we should have. Structurally, these focused on two debates. One was centralization versus decentralization. Should we have a central bank that is focused in one place or dispersed throughout the country? The second debate was, should it be public or should it be private? There were many who didn't want a central bank at all, they were thinking, well, we've already got essentially that, the U.S. Treasury, so it's a public, centralized system. That was sort of the status quo. The alternatives here were the Aldrich Plan, which had the longest process of vetting and incubation, which was the Republican Plan. I'm taking, of course, not a picture drawn by Nelson Aldrich in defense of his plan, but drawn by his critics. That was going to be centralized and private, centralized in New York City under the control almost exclusively of private bankers. On the 40-person board, three would be governmental appointees, not including anyone with an executive function. The other side was the Glass Plan. As the Democratic tides were turning, the Democrats took first the House, then the Senate and the White House in 1910 and 1912, respectively. And his vision was to have a decentralized system with as many as 50 reserve banks. The number he actually threw around most often was 20. But his idea was that we want a decentralized private system. And here's his quote for why. The United States, with its immense area, numerous natural divisions, still more numerous competing divisions and abundant outlets to foreign currencies, there's no argument, either in banking theory or of expediency, which dictates the creation of a single central banking institution, no matter how skillfully managed, how carefully controlled, how patriotically conducted. Neither of those plans won. In its place came the Wilsonian Compromise. And Wilson thought himself something of a James Madison as an institution builder and constitution maker. He was a political theorist and a historian, and this was his constitutional moment, and he seized it. The result was the Federal Reserve System, that was quite unlike the one that we had to have today, quite unlike the Aldrich Plan, and quite unlike the Glass Plan. And that was that we would have 8 to 12 reserve banks. The number was eventually set at 12 after the legislation, with a Federal Reserve Board that was consisted of public appointees, chaired by the administration's Secretary of the Treasury, ex officio, and then these reserve banks spread throughout the country. So on this graph, which you should have in the papers that you've been given, this chart, we've got these two poles, centralized versus decentralized, private leadership versus public leadership, Wilsonian compromise right in the middle. And the tradition of other great constitutional-type compromises, this one was utterly ambiguous as to who would wield the power, and as a consequence, became something of a failure. Now, when I say that it failed, and failed miserably in the sense of from a governance perspective, I'm not putting a gloss on history. Nearly everyone agreed that from the very beginning, before the Fed even opened its doors, there were contests for power among the reserve banks, between the reserve banks and the Federal Reserve Board. And this lasted until the New Deal. Now, one of the biggest questions for economic historians is what caused the Great Depression? As then Princeton economist Ben Bernanke put it, this is the holy grail of research questions for economic historians. I'm very suspicious of monocausal explanations, but roughly no one in economic history disputes the Fed's role in at least exacerbating the Great Depression. And while the critiques are almost always on the functions of the Fed, I think this was also a governance failure. So in comes Mariner Eccles and Franklin Roosevelt. Mariner Eccles, one of the most colorful figures in Fed history, was a Mormon millionaire banker from Utah, son of a bigamist, and someone more radical than Franklin Roosevelt. He was Keynesian before Keynes, and his ideas about the government's role in responding to economic depression and financial crisis made him far to the left of virtually everyone within the administration. He was offered what was then called the governorship of the Federal Reserve Board, and he rejected it. Absolutely not. Why would I take that? He said, his direct quote is, "I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole unless fundamental changes were made to the Federal Reserve System." As his assistant, Lachlan Curry, said, "Such an organization as the Fed, it's almost impossible to place definite responsibility anywhere. The layman is completely bewildered by all the officers, banks, and boards. Even the outside experts know only the legal forms." So here came the 1935 Act. This was a radical restructuring of the Fed. It demoted the Federal Reserve banks. They got not the regal term governor to apply to themselves, but the more pedestrian president. Governors instead was reserved to the newly created Board of Governors established in 1935. One of my favorite items that I have in my research on the Fed is a mug that was issued in 2013. It says, "Board of Governors, Federal Reserve System, 100 years. I love this mug so much because it's telling us all a very malicious lie. The Board of Governors was founded in 1935, not 1913, and this point is a very profound one. Going back to this chart, the Banking Act undid the Wilsonian Compromise. The problem, undid it by rendering the reserve banks subordinate to the newly formed Board of Governors in all matters regulatory and supervisory. Had Eccles had his way, the reserve banks would have had absolutely no role in national policymaking. Eccles, though, disobeyed that rule from applied philosopher Omar Little. If you're going to attack the king, you best not miss. And he came attacking the king. That's a reference to The Wire. Thank you for the one person who watches The Wire. I appreciate that. He missed. He came at the king and he missed. He was a terrible politician. Carter Glass, that great patriarch of the reserve banks, placed them in a minority position on the FOMC, even as the statute made crystal clear that with all matters supervisory and regulatory, they were in fact subordinate. But again, because they continued in this role, their ability to influence national policy has continued. Now, what's the problem with this? Well, in good times, not much. I mean, the reserve banks serve a vital function. Their presidents are placed there under pre-Dodd-Frank, almost exclusively under the influence of private bankers. Post-Dodd-Frank, still largely under the influence of private bankers. And during good times, they serve a vital information gathering and coordination function. But in this way, I think that they're much like the gallbladder of American financial system. They serve an important but non-vital function in good times, and in bad times, they can threaten to bring down the entire system. And as with gallbladder, I'm wondering if we shouldn't have something of a surgery here and do something about the reserve banks. I'm going to save for the paper and my other work exactly what I think the problems are, and let me go very, very briefly as my time is out on what we should do. So number one, just increase the public accountability by making the reserve bank presidents presidential appointments. There's a constitutional issue, in fact, that I discussed in the paper that would be resolved in this way. They're principal officers, arguably, of the United States government, but they're put there by bankers. That seems kind of an odd structure. This has the demerit, this proposal has the demerit of having a 19-person committee deciding so much of our monetary and regulatory policy. That's kind of unwieldy. So an alternative might be one that's pending before the Congress, which is just give focus on the New York Fed president. He's unmistakably first among equals within the system. So just change his role to being appointed not by New York bankers, but by the president and confirmed by the Senate. I like this proposal too. One the aspect of it that I don't like is then, you know, Bank of America is a banking juggernaut, as is Wells Fargo, neither of whom is regulated by the New York Fed. Would we be less concerned about their governance structures? I don't think so. But again, I like this. I like this trend in that direction. The one I like the best, and the one I'll leave you with, is that we just finish the job that Mariner Eccles and Franklin Roosevelt started by rendering the reserve banks plainly and unmistakably subordinate to the Board of Governors. Carter Glass's original conception was not even to have 12 banks. Why do we need two in the state of Missouri and only one west of Dallas? Instead, we can have them wherever the Board of Governors wants to put them and have them be branch offices of the central bank. Out of interest of self-preservation, I'll say, because my respondent is the former Philadelphia Fed President, Charles Plosser, I think this proposal really should just be to 11 of the reserve banks. Philadelphia should stay where it is. And I'll leave you there. Thank you.
So good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. This is a wonderful place to come talk. It's a fascinating conference, and I want to thank David for inviting me to ask him why he wanted me to come talk about this paper. And he said, because I thought you'd have a different perspective. And indeed, I certainly do have a different perspective. And so now we can, for something completely different. You know, I think this paper is fascinating. It's a fun read. I learned a lot of history in or at least history through at least Peter's lens. And I think the title sort of tells it all. It says, The Problem of the Federal Reserve Banks. And Peter's view seems to be that no matter what lens he looks through, reserve banks are a failure. And then he asserts at the end, and he said this in his remarks, that they can threaten the entire system under the wrong circumstances. So, again, I think there's a lot of interesting material. Again, it's a fun read. But I confess that at the end, I didn't find his arguments very compelling. I didn't think his evidence was very persuasive to support the kind of conclusions he's come to. And so what I'm going to do in my discussion is try to give you where those doubts come from. And since I don't have terribly long, I'm going to try to make them brief. I'm going to start up front by saying I am not a lawyer. And I have no stand on the constitutional issues that occupy a fair amount of that paper. I don't have any particular insights into that, and it wouldn't be useful for me to go there. I would simply make one observation about the legal entanglements, and that is that Federal Reserve banks have been around for 100 years. FOMC has been around for 80 years. There have been many revisions to the Federal Reserve Act over the years. And you'd think that if there was true economic or policy harm being done by this governance structure, you might have thought that over 100 years, somebody could have made the cogent case well enough to either get the Federal Reserve Act changed or taken to the court mechanism. So I guess as a positive statement, maybe he's right, but as a practical statement, it seems like there hasn't been enough evidence to really push the courts or Congress into doing something different. So I agree with Peter. I think there's a huge element of this centralization versus decentralization in the nature of the founding of the Federal Reserve in the 1913 Act. It was obviously a reaction to a very centralized first and second banks of the United States, which didn't work out so well from many people's perspective. And so there was this tension between centralization and decentralization. But I would also remind the audience that we were still under a gold standard. Monetary policy wasn't a particularly important function at the time. And indeed, the Federal Reserve banks were set up more to create an elastic currency. And they were modeled, in a practical sense, after the clearinghouses. Private clearinghouses scattered throughout the country actually worked pretty well in many circumstances. Not always, but these clearinghouses provided a kind of like elastic currency to the banks that were members of the clearinghouses. So these reserve banks were anticipated to provide a clearinghouse function for the nation at large, backed by a sort of systematic way of doing that. But the model was a private model, a model where banks joined the clearinghouse, put in capital, subjected themselves to oversight by some degree of the clearinghouse, and then the clearinghouse provided for redemption, circulation, currencies in needed to help prevent bank runs and panics and even just seasonal variations in the demand for cash. So it wasn't such an unusual concept from my perspective about why they were set up the way they did. And again, monetary policy being under a gold standard played less of a role. Now, during one of the themes of this paper is the claim that the private dimension of the reserve banks has led the banks and the presidents in particular to be captured by the bankers in their districts. And I think it's really this feature that he stresses the most in his claim that the system has failed. It doesn't really help us very much in saying, well, why does the system that he proposes fix any of these problems? I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Peter also talks about the 1935 and 1937 reforms. They were profound repudiations, if you will, of the Reserve Bank model. I guess here, too, I see history a little bit differently. By the mid-1930s, we had left the gold standard. So the role of the Fed now was taking on a different function above and beyond just kind of reacting to the gold standard and acting as a clearinghouse. So the role of the Fed was changing. Monetary policy and price determination in terms of their interaction with the central bank were beginning to change. So the world had changed, and the model was adjusted accordingly. I would note that the increase in authority provided to the new centralized board of governors was also not unusual for the time. This was Roosevelt. This was the New Deal. All across the board, the Roosevelt government and administration was consolidating authority in Washington, granting more power. One might look at this event as just one more example of that movement in history towards a more centralized authority. Whether that was the right thing to do, a good thing to do, a bad thing to do, is a question we could debate, but I'm not going to do that here. So it's certainly been shown that some of that consolidation or centralizing authority isn't always necessarily beneficial or desirable. I'll also make one more brief observation. Most economists think that it was the Fed-Treasury Accord in 1951, which was the central event in establishing Fed independence. Excessive inflation following World War II, which came in direct conflict with the political desires to keep interest rates low. That led to a conflict between the Fed and the administration. And these efforts obviously manifested themselves in the Fed-Treasury Accord, granting independence to the Fed to conduct monetary policy. Now, efforts such as this to politicize the decisions of the Fed are not new, and I would argue oftentimes lead to bad outcomes. Peter seems to suggest that independence is some quirky notion that arose in the 1980s and 90s. I don't agree with that. The Bank of England was independent long before, for many hundreds of years before World War I, which is when it lost its independence under World War I. But independence was not a unique phenomenon that just arose in the latter half of the 20th century. In fact, most economists would argue that, in fact, independence economists tend to be in favor of independence because independent central banks have better outcomes. So I want to talk for a few minutes now about, well, what are the three biggest Fed failures? Now, This is not a unique list. I'm just going to come up with three topics that I think are largely attributed to failures of the Federal Reserve System. And I think it's worthwhile to think about that and then ask the question whether these failures somehow would have been, were caused by the Reserve Banks and their governance structure. And if so or not, what would have the proposals that, Peter suggested changed any of those outcomes? Let me first talk about the Great Depression briefly. So I'm talking about three of them. The Fed clearly didn't act very well as in providing elastic currency in the Great Depression. Its big failure, of course, was letting banks fail. Now, of course, it was torn in that episode because it was struggling with following the rules of the gold standard, which told it to do one thing, trying to stop what it perceived as speculation in the credit markets, and the falling price level of the banks in trouble. He was struggling with those. I think it's fair to say that economists and the Fed didn't really understand the complexity of those sets of issues. I think our models and theories about that were not well understood. And as a result, the Fed allowed hundreds of banks to fail. Now, if you're allowing hundreds of banks to fail, it's pretty hard to argue that you must have been captured by the private bankers on the boards, and yet you still went ahead and let all these banks fail. So I think it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily strong evidence that that it was capture and it was the private nature of this structure that was really important. I'm not sure that's a compelling case for something wrong with the structure. We turn to the great inflation. High rates of inflation in the 70s and early 80s can also be considered one of the Fed's major failings. Here again, it's hard to argue that the failure was due to the governance structure. The story, whether apocryphal or literally true, was that President Johnson took William McChesney Martin by the lapels and shook him until he was willing to say, yes, we'll support the Great Society and the war in Vietnam with easy money. And, of course, that wasn't a much better lesson between Arthur Burns and Richard Nixon following. So whether the political pressure was so blatant as that or not, I don't really know. I've heard that was true. But the effect was the same. The failure was an outcome of too much political control, not of insufficient political control. Why would the governance model suggested in this paper have yielded a different outcome in that circumstance? So much of the arguments in this paper rest on the financial crisis, and that's what I'll talk about last. It rests on the presumption of the financial crisis and the presumed failings of the Fed in the regulatory arena, not the monetary policy arena, the regulatory arena, that there's a certain that Reserve Bank presidents are captured by their boards and bankers, and this leads to this governance structure is a major threat to good policy. First and foremost, and Peter mentions this, regulatory authority is a delegated authority to the Reserve Banks. Reserve Bank presidents play no role, particularly in regulation. Their staffs are boots on the ground, if you will, but they're not deeply involved in the regulatory issues directly. So why does changing the makeup of the FOMC affect this problem? I don't think it does. The governors have the authority even to remove a president for cause, and a good cause would be the president failing to deliver on the regulatory directions and authorities that the board intended it to have. So my point is not to absolve the Board of Governors or the presidents of any responsibility for regulatory mishaps. We clearly made some. Capture is a real concern for regulatory agencies of all sorts and must be guarded against. What I will argue is that there's no compelling evidence that says the structure of the Fed was an important factor. The crisis, if in fact the crisis arose from excess deference to bankers, then it was shared by a lot of people, not just the Fed. Consider the other regulatory agencies. The OCC, they regulate and supervise national banks, including J.P. Morgan and Citibank. The OTS, Office of Thrift Supervision, was responsible for the thrift industry. AIG was a thrift holding company. WaMu, Countrywide. Huge failures of both oversight and responsibility. The FDIC has responsibility for state-chartered non-member banks. The SEC had responsibility for investment banks, including Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. And the old office of, I think it was called OFAO, if I recall, had responsibility for the GSEs. Now, these agencies did not have the governance structure that Peter despises so much in the Fed. Their leaderships and supervisors were had a direct line of sight, so to speak. Yet they missed important dimensions of excess risk-taking, and the OTS was obviously most egregious. Indeed, in the early 2000s, it was Alan Greenspan and Bill Poole, who was president of the St. Louis Fed, who repeatedly warned of the financial fragility of the GSEs and urged Congress to require more capital in those agencies. Congress refused to comply. Think of the other countries, the UK, the FSA failed, Northern Rock, Lloyd's of London. My point is that one is hard-pressed, I think, to make the claim that it's the Fed's governance structure that was the source of all these problems or failures. Everyone, every agency, regardless of the government structure, fell short. Thus, I don't see much evidence that imposing a different governance structure on the Fed would have led to any different outcome than we had. So in summary, I see this paper as a solution in search of a problem. From my perspective, some of the biggest Fed failures over time have come from the excessive political influence, not the lack of political control. Here I see the Reserve Banks as offering, from my perspective, somewhat of a buffer to protect political control from Congress. The Federal Reserve is an interesting institution. But like many institutions in and out of government, it's evolved and changed over time and continues to do so. Ben Bernanke addressed very important issues of transparency, accountability, and independence. These are good principles, and I believe the Fed will continue that journey. The biggest danger I see is the risk of making the Fed less independent, more susceptible to the short-term political whims that constantly buffet Washington. That is where true policy risks are likely to come from. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you. As a reporter covering the Federal Reserve, I have often been in search of new and different metaphors. But it never occurred to me to use to describe the Federal Reserve banks as the gallbladder of the American economy. So, if for nothing else, we got that. You got something for coming out today. I want to mention, and I should have, that Peter's paper is on our website, or if it isn't, it will be shortly. And as he suggested, it has a lot of more detail, institutional detail, and a big discussion of the constitutionality of the Reserve Banks, which he questions. Viral's paper in the second section is not going to be on the website, but it will be in a couple of weeks. Charlie, let me just ask you, start with one question to you. So,
I thought this was about his paper.
It is. But I want to ask something about you, Sid, then I'm going to. So, do you see any questions of legitimacy that the Federal Reserve banks are not government institutions, and this perception, which Peter shared, that somehow they're controlled by the bankers. Do you think that that has any role to play in the antipathy, political antipathy to the Fed?
A lot of things can play a role in the antipathy towards the Fed. I think that can come from lots of different sources. My own personal reaction is that a lot of the antipathy.
Okay. My fault. I started it wrong.
You started it.
Hostility.
Hostility towards the Fed has not emanated from the Reserve Banks. It's emanated from the general policy decisions. I mean, if you think about the bailouts under Section 13.3, Reserve Banks, that's a board function.
Right, but the public
decision.
Doesn't always look at that, right?
I understand that. So the question then becomes, I think it is a question about understanding the Fed and being more transparent about what decisions get made and how they make them. I agree with that. But legitimacy, I think, is not quite the right way to think about it. I mean, I said I wasn't going to get involved in the legal stuff because I can't make those arguments. But we are created by an act of Congress. So in some sense, it's legal.
Now, whether or not you can find a better institutional design, perhaps, but it seems to me you've got to relate that better design to sort of where the failings are and make sure that your new design, whatever it happens to be, fixes the problems.
So do you think Peter suggests having the presidents appointed by the Board of Governors?
So you'd make presidents sort of senior staff people, essentially.
And you think that would be a bad idea?
I don't see what it would accomplish.
And what about particularly, Dick Fisher's?
So just to elaborate that a little bit, I think many of the failings that that Peter alludes to and other people allude to are most, or in many cases, in the realm of regulatory and supervisory actions, of which the presidents are mostly out of the loop anyway. I think the criticisms of monetary policy, maybe they're good, maybe they're bad, regardless of what I think of them individually. Certainly 13-3 lending bailouts are a responsibility of the board. So I think the question then becomes, you can't lump, from my perspective, monetary policy and regulatory policy into the same discussion. I think they're different, and you have to recognize that they're different.
So, Peter, let me ask you one question about something you said and then let you respond to what Mr. Blosser said. You suggested that the Reserve Bank presidents are under the influence of private bankers.
Yep.
Now, I know there is that perception, but do you really think that's true? I mean, there is a board of directors at each Federal Reserve Bank. There are 9 people. 6 of them are appointed by the banks. The bankers themselves on the board no longer play a role in the selection of the president. The Board of Governors essentially has veto over the appointment of any president. Do you really think that that's the problem? The Reserve Bank presidents are, quote, under the influence of bankers?
I really do. The legalistic formalism is important here, Mended and Dodd-Frank, as you're alluding. But it's not true that the bankers on the board have absolutely no role in their selection. They are sitting on a board with their friends and talking to each other. They're going to talk over coffee and snacks about, well, what do you think of this candidate versus another? We don't have a formal vote. But that doesn't mean that their influence isn't felt. And we know this analogously on the FOMC. The FOMC isn't a 12-person committee. It's a 19-person committee. It's just that 12 vote. The other 7 are actively participating in that discussion. So I think the bankers are absolutely still in that mix, participating in the discussion of who the Reserve Bank presidents will be. And then, importantly, Dodd-Frank did nothing to change who gets to fire summarily the Reserve Bank president. It's ambiguous as to whether the Board of Governors can fire for cause the Reserve Banks, because the Federal Reserve Act has another provision that says that the Board of Directors, all 3 classes, can fire at pleasure the Reserve Bank president or any other officer within the Reserve Bank. So I think you play for them that brought you, and the Reserve Banks are coming through the active, formal, legal, and active, informal, non-statutory participation of bankers who are participating in that. Now, does that mean they're just shilling for the banks? That mean that they're puppets? No, absolutely not. And I'm not just saying that because Charles Plosser is sitting to my right. But Reserve Bank presidents are distinguished academics and increasingly macroeconomists who are absolutely a part of this system. The question is that kind of influence and whether we in the public can say, this was a decision that was reached by the Fed. Who participated in that decision, and how can I participate in a political process if I don't like it?
And Mr. Plosser suggested that your paper is a solution in search of a problem. Do we have any reason to believe that the decisions that the Fed has made on either monetary policy or supervisory policy would have been different with a different governance structure?
Sure. Counterfactuals are the historian's playground, so I would be delighted to talk at great length about some of those. But I'll give you a couple of examples where I think differences would have been could have occurred. So Mr. Plosser says that 13-3 is a board function. That's the Reserve Banks have nothing to do with that, and that's true as the law is written, except that 13-3 requires the participation of the Reserve Banks. The Reserve Banks have to be satisfied with the collateral presented before the board can even vote on this emergency lending, something that hasn't been changed by Dodd-Frank. And so I think you see in Tim Geithner's excellent memoir just how actively the New York Fed president was participating in these kinds of decisions. And if I have a problem with those, I can at least direct some of my ire to the Board of Governors. But that doesn't change the fact you can fire every one of the governors, and then the Reserve Bank presidents still are there participating in those decisions
influencing them, and then, not trivially, implementing them. And it's in the implementation where things can get
real. But that's all hypothetical. He says, but what would have been different? So you think if Tim Geithner had been appointed by the Board of Governors that somehow Lehman's collateral would have been seen as more worthy?
I can't make that point definitively in the counterfactual, but I would be very interested in a time machine and a new statute to go back and see how that would have played out differently. I think the idea that it would not have played out differently is not likely.
Okay. Mr. Plasser, Peter mentions, and Richard Fisher has been pushing this notion, well, the New York Fed is so important that that ought to be a presidential appointment. You think that's a good idea? What's the advantage of...
out of this job for one day.
Yeah, I know.
Mr. Plasser said to me, why do you want me? I will have retired. And I said, that's why I want you. You have no excuse not to answer the question.
So I think it's a legitimate question to ask the following, and that is that... What's the role you want the presidents to play? Okay. What's the right role for what function do they serve? I happen to believe they serve an important function in helping preserve independence as well as executing monetary policy. After all, the Board of Governors doesn't have a balance sheet, doesn't have any income. It's all comes from the Reserve Bank's balance sheets. So I think it's important to talk about that. I think that there's an argument to be made that if you want a more decentralized structure, then you could make the argument that maybe you really want the presidents to play more of a role, not less of a role, be even less political than they already might be, or less beholden to a particular interest. I think it's a tough choice, but I think the Reserve Banks have had a history of contributing positively to monetary policy debates. It's a source of, I think, innovation in policy making and monetary theory, where they bring new ideas to the table. They aren't always accepted, but you oftentimes see over time where those ideas begin to
be. I don't think I heard the answer to the question. So you think it's a good idea?
Good training at the Fed.
So
I have argued that I think I made this argument in a couple of speeches. Might not be a bad idea to have all 12 reserve banks participate equally rather than giving special stature to the New York Fed. Rotate all six of them every other year. I don't think that would necessarily be a bad outcome. And it would actually achieve some of the goals that Peter at least mentioned about the fact that the New York Fed is sort of head and shoulders.
Wouldn't making the president of the New York Fed a presidential appointee sort of elevate the New York Fed even more over the other reserve banks?
Probably.
Yeah. And let me just, so.
Oh, no, not probably, yes. I'm sorry. I didn't need to equivocate.
Why is it important to have these private sector boards of directors? The Bank of England was essentially nationalized during World War II. The European Central Bank has a model of decentralization, and that the reserve banks of the member countries
model a lot off the Fed,
right? But they're all government appointees. If Peter says the private sector boards raise some legal issue, and I suggest that it adds to the public perception that somehow the central bank is not operating exclusively in the public interest, what purpose is served by this 80-year-old atavism of having private sector directors of the banks?
Look, I would be open to consider other structures for our boards of directors, but I would argue that three of the directors are appointed by Washington already, three of them are non-bankers, elected by bankers, but non-bankers, and only three are bankers. I could see changing that mix under some circumstances, and I'd be open to discussions about how that. But I think that part of how the Fed, I believe, maintains its independence to conduct monetary policy is part and parcel of the interaction that the reserve banks have in their districts, with their business communities, with their bankers for sure, but business communities, community leaders, and the person on Main Street. And I think that is a source of a buffer, if you will, to help preserve our independence. And I think it would be not be a good thing to lose that, because we've already seen over history that many times it's the political influences that drive the decisions.
So isn't it true that in recent times the presence of the Reserve Bank presidents has given the Fed an insulation against political interference? I mean, Dodd-Frank is a case study in that the Reserve Bank presidents were deployed by the board because they had more clout.
Absolutely. The Reserve Bank presidents and these very directors. I mean, just imagine this. If you've got in the 12 Reserve Bank districts, you've got 9 directors, and then not to mention the 6 directors on each of the branches, who are pillars of their community. So even if they're arch conservatives, if they are a part of the reserve system and they're calling up their conservative senators and saying, you know what, Ben Bernanke is my guy, then you're getting a very different political dynamic. And this isn't speculative. This is exactly what happened during.
Right, but did that serve to help the central bank be independent of politicians, that they had this broader base of support?
This is why I think so much of the discussion of central bank independence is almost incoherent. That you mean by injecting so completely into the political system, they were independent of politics?
Very confusing to me. Talk Congress out of doing things that would have made it more difficult for the Fed to pursue an independent monetary policy.
No, and here's why. Because where they were focusing a lot of that attention was on changes to regulatory and supervisory functions. So taking out of the Federal Reserve System entirely bank regulation for banks under $5 billion. And this was something that was going to occur until the Reserve Banks stood up and said no.
Okay, so I'm going to take about 5 minutes worth of questions, and we'll have more time at the end for more questions. I'm going to gather 3 questions, and then we'll answer. There's one in the back here, and Phil Wallach in the front, and Krishna.
Good morning. I'm J.W. Verrett, chief economist at the House Financial Services Committee, and I work on our Fed reform efforts. I want to ask a quick question about the paper and of Dr. Plosser. It seems that a dimension that the paper doesn't fully appreciate to me is the differences between the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the other district banks. And to talk specifically about 13.3, it appeared from reading the FOMC minutes of 2008, where some of the special liquidity facilities were discussed, it seemed like all the opposition to that came from the district banks, particularly President Lacker at the Richmond Fed. And that seems to me to be a counterpoint to your argument about the district banks sort of dancing with the one that brung you. And so I wonder just to ask Dr. Brown if he's sort of missing, as you focus on that vertical dimension of board versus district bank, you're missing some of the horizontal disagreements where the New York Fed differs very much from the Richmond Fed and maybe the Philly Fed and maybe the Kansas City Fed and some of the other very different institutions within the regional banks. And I want to ask Dr. Plosser, you've spoken a lot about 13.3. You're mentioned today some thoughts about how the district banks can help the Fed's independence. I wonder if you think there might be a role to play for the district banks in 13.3. Specifically, currently, the Dodd-Frank Act requires a supermajority of the board to approve extraordinary lending. Would there be any good sense in requiring a supermajority of the district banks to also approve lending before that 13.3 turnkey is turned? So I just want to throw that out there for discussion.
Okay. Phil Wallach here. Brandon, Phil, can you raise your hand? Krishna, can you raise your hand so the mic can come to you?
Hi, Phil Wallach from Brookings. I'm just wondering if Mr. Plosser can talk a little bit more descriptively about what the connection with the local communities that the regional feds get is like. I think that's rather obscure to a lot of us trying to understand exactly what role the regional feds play.
I mean what the actual function is? What describing the
not the function, but the connections with the local banking communities.
Banking community or the broader communities.
It's a little hard. You said that the regional feds act as a source of good ideas coming sort of from different perspectives. If you could just give us a little bit more color about how that might happen through those connections.
Right, Krishna? Thank you.
Thank you. So Krishna Guha, formerly with the New York Fed, but speaking here only for myself, of course. A comment and a question, if I may. The comment is that I thought the paper raised some – had a very interesting and thoughtful discussion of the constitutional issues, principal officers, appointments clause, and so forth. By contrast, I was actually very troubled by what I thought was an inaccurate and partial narrative around the role of the New York Fed in recent years. All I would say is that a lot of this discussion has been very difficult because of legal confidentiality, but I can vouch from personal experience, for instance, that the New York Fed specifically played a very prominent role in the stress tests and development of CCAR, which has been very tough on the banks, held back dividends and so forth, and in the creation of new risk capital standards, where the New York Fed specifically was at the forefront globally of pushing for very tough changes to risk capital weight. So I'd encourage you to develop a sort of more balanced discussion of the issues there. The question here really has to do with whether the kind of proposals that you you recommend, and indeed believe are constitutionally required, might not have unintended and negative consequences of their own. And here I really worry about the supposition that having a stronger political role in the selection of senior Fed officials will lead to better outcomes. I'd point to the SEC as an institution that has been really hampered by the politicization of its independence in ways where we can show concrete cost to society. One might also say that the Supreme Court, frankly, has been at least exposed to some of those similar critiques in recent years. When you look at political influence of banks, do not think this runs exclusively or even primarily through boards of directors. It importantly runs through congressional committees. And you'll see that there's been much discussion of late, for instance, about the derivatives push-out clause. So I'd urge you to be very careful that you don't worsen a problem through the remedies that you propose.
Krishna, you sound a little skeptical about the birth of democracy here. Let me start with you and on some of them, and then we'll go to Mr. Plasser. So particularly I think the gentleman from the House committee made the point that some of the Reserve Bank presidents who were not from New York were pretty hard on the bank.
So just a correction just so that my advisor doesn't kill me when I get back to Princeton. I'm not Dr. Brown yet, just to be clear.
JD,
if we want to call it, which I do not. The horizontal dimension, so this is referring to, I recommend anyone interested in this to read the 2008 transcripts. There's a very dramatic moment between the Richmond Fed president Lacker versus Tim Geithner, where it's a gotcha moment, where Lacker is asking, are you having these secret conversations with including member banks in my district about 13-3? And Geithner says no, and then he says, well, actually you are, and here's the evidence. It's a pretty dramatic moment. And so I think that's a really good instance. Why is that tethered to the governance structure, right? Why is that tethered to the fact that these as opposed to just a multiplicity of voices? I would wonder about that. Can I respond to the stress test question?
Let me go to Mr. Plasser first, and then back to you. So, Mr. Plasser, one, should the banks be more involved in 13-3, and how do you actually interact with the communities in which you?
So. Ben and Don have heard me talk about 13-3 before for many years, but I actually have a different perspective on 13-3. I actually believe that the Fed should be as separated from fiscal policy decisions as we possibly can be. And that means 13-3 lending, from my perspective, was a worrisome activity for the Fed because we were making fiscal choices about who to bail out or who not to bail out, who to lend money to, what creditors to protect and which ones not to protect. I find that problematic for the Fed to be doing. I'd rather have a different structure where in emergencies the Fed would instruct, the Treasury would instruct the Fed to carry out an operation perhaps of that kind if it needed to be. But then if the Fed acquired the underlying securities, that they would immediately be swapped for Treasury securities to keep the Fed out of the playing ground of winning. And so I just prefer a different structure for 13-3. Okay. In terms of the community, you know, all the Reserve Banks have advisory committees of various kinds. They have community outreach programs. We do surveys. We interact with everything from schools to businesses to not-for-profit organizations. So we have a team of people, not just the president, but a lot of other people doing outreach, doing things about the business community. So in some sense, the richness and the engagement of Fed personnel with their local districts is pretty extraordinary. And it brings to the table, I think, a picture of the economy that it's very hard for the Board of Governors to see, because they just don't have the time, the mechanisms for actually doing a lot of that. So I think it's a very, and I think most, and this is perhaps to Peter's political point, in most districts around the country, most Fed districts, what you find is that the people in the districts, the average day person who hears a speech by somebody from the Fed or goes to talk to them, they have a much more positive view of their reserve banks than they do of the Fed as a whole. And I think that speaks to sort of part of what this is all about. But
okay. Finally, do you want to respond to the last point?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I make one more point?
Please.
We talked about bringing new ideas. When I talk about the question was asked, part of the new ideas really is about the fact that the Reserve Bank presidents do have a research staff, and they are free. And what the Reserve Bank's research staffs do, along with their presidents, is help prevent the Fed or try to put a check on what I would describe as the dangers of groupthink. Walter Lippmann once said, you know, where all men think alike, no one thinks very much. And I think that the research staffs and the functions of the presidents are in part a mechanism for making sure a variety of ideas and things get discussed and put on the table. That doesn't mean they're always accepted, of course not, but it means we have the debate about them.
And so, Peter, last word on the New York Fed. It's not captured. And what about Krishna's point that getting the politicians more involved may not lead to better policy, even though it's nicer for a lawyer?
Sure. So I wouldn't say that the Constitution is just something that's nice for lawyers. I think that's pretty important, too. And we had an almost David Frost, Richard Nixon moment where we said, if the Congress does it, it must be legal. I'm resistant to that conclusion.
It's fine.
But to the point we raised, you know, that the New York Fed is not all bad, I totally and completely agree with this. The New York Fed, and this isn't just kind of I'm not a politician, so you can know that this isn't a politician's glib comment. Extraordinarily talented people work in the reserve banks doing public-facing, public-oriented work. The problem is that even that work, I can't as a citizen evaluate and say, yes, this is what I like, and so I'm going to participate in this work by saying, I like the Reserve Bank President Bill Dudley because he did this thing in the stress test that was very important. As I'm voting in this mix of issues on presidential and congressional elections, this is something that's important to me. It's off the table, and it's wrapped in opacity. You talked about questions of legal sensitivity. And as a lawyer and as a scholar, I think the Reserve Banks actually go aggressively too far, even there, saying, no, you can't even know what our doomsday book is in the event of a crisis, because that's too secret. And I think there a little bit more transparency would go a very long way. And this is actually a good way to summarize it. First of all, Dr. Plaster, I think that your comments and responses were very, very good. I'm grateful that you read the paper as closely as you did and had your feedback. I think my point to all of this is to say not, you know, would this have prevented the Great Depression? Would it have prevented the financial crisis? The question is instead, is this giving us the central bank that exists away from the day-to-day of electoral politics without creating, in appearance and in fact, the fodder for conspiracy theories that this is the creature of Jekyll Island, that this is the many-headed hydra that works for the banks? Rand Paul was not asking the question, do you ever feel like the Fed's out to get you? To a group of bankers. He was asking a group of Iowans this, and I think that question gets a lot less wind in its sails when the answer is, look, I know exactly who put the key decision makers there, and I'm going to vote for those candidates or against them because of the way that those policies shake out against my worldview.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Leave your mics behind.
Right, now we're going to have a technological experiment. So we had invited today Viral Acharya, who's a professor at the finance at New York University, to speak about a new development in central banking that harkens back to its origins, the origins of the Federal Reserve. I speak of this expanded mandate for financial stability, some of it explicit in the law, some of it implicit, that we've asked the Fed to do, I think, more than we had before. That is, it's not enough to maintain price stability and aim for maximum sustainable employment. We've also asked them to make sure we don't have to go through anything as wrenching as we did before. Now, of course, as Mr. Plasser mentioned, this is very much in the origins of the Federal Reserve. The financial stability was one of its original purposes, I think. So what we're going to do is, if this all works, Viral's on the phone. He's going to speak. He has slides, and Cary Grant is here, is going to turn the slides. He's promised me to limit his presentation to 15 minutes, and I'm going to get up here and interrupt him if he doesn't. And then Jeremy Stein, a former member of the Fed Board of Governors, a professor of economics at Harvard, will respond. And then we're going to try and have a little dialogue. I'm going to be assisted by my colleague Don Cohn, also formerly the Federal Reserve, now on the Financial Stability Committee, Financial Policy Committee of the Bank of England. And we'll see if we can have a little bit of a conversation, even though two of our participants are remote. So with that, Viral, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, David.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Sorry I can't be there, thanks to the weather alert at Washington, D.C. What I want to talk about today is a slightly different take on the central banking design than the first paper. Maybe a little bit closer to Charlie Ploss's remarks that maybe the biggest issue we ought to worry about is the political economy influences on central banking decisions. And how should that, to head against that, to guard against that, how should we design central banking, especially the financial stability mandate? And the view I'm going to present is really sort of an institution's view that's very common in the law and finance literature, in finance and economics. And it's the idea that that in a democracy, for things to work well, you have to identify specific problems to solve and design institutions that are sort of tailor-made to solve those problems. And then once they are designed, you don't have too much influence from the political system on these institutions. And I would argue that financial stability is one such problem that needs to be solved. Central banks, broadly designed, are an institution out there to solve this problem, and that we have to design it in a manner that we can limit the political economy influences on this. And the point I want to stress is that this political independence of the central bank is something that is managed by the central bank pretty much on an ongoing basis. And the more they are forced to venture into an area that that prevents them from So if they have to venture into an area to maintain political stability, but that's going to risk political interference, it leads to inaction, and that this is something that can be undesirable from the standpoint of financial stability in the long run. Okay, so let me move to the second slide. So Charlie Ploss alluded to the 1907 crisis, and so did the first speaker. I think it's interesting to think back as to what really brought about the Federal Reserve after the 1907 crisis, and it was the problem that we had well-functioning private commercial bank clearing house at that point. But there were entities other than commercial banks that were getting into trouble. These were trust companies, and they looked very much like the broker-dealers or investment banks in the most recent crisis. And both the allocation of the treasury liquidity as well as the private liquidity that the bankers put together in the end to save the banking was essentially distributed by John Pierpont Morgan at that point. And while that happened, there were some questions as to whether he derived some private gains for companies that were supported by his banks. And more importantly, it was felt, should the allocation of public liquidity be outsourced to a private entity? Should financial stability be outsourced to a private entity? And at least my reading of The House of Morgan by Ron Chernow suggested that this was one of the impetus behind the creation of the Federal Reserve, to have an institution that's designed to stabilize the interbank market, stabilize panics in order to get a grip on crisis and panics. Now, of course, what the Federal Reserve does has evolved substantially over time. In the financial stability mandate, it does crisis management through a lender of last resort function. It does crisis prevention through an important supervision and other kinds of regulatory tools that it deploys. And then Other objectives have been added, such as long-run price stability, employment, and so on, and I'll come back to these a bit later. Now, one popular central banking perspective is that the problem that central banks are trying to solve, and therefore how we should design central banks, is all about how to solve the problem that we get crises every now and then because of private sector excesses, and that we have to find some good ways of dealing with them. And it's a very typical time inconsistency problem, which is that central banks can do lender of last resort in the midst of a crisis. It's desirable that they do this to an extent in order to preserve the financial. I'm on to slide 3 in case I didn't say this. But this creates a moral hazard problem, which is that entities that benefit from lender of last resort might not shy away from taking high risk, high leverage in good times. And so then the central bank has to design macroprudential regulation, to design capital requirements, liquidity requirements. It's not enough to do this because the private sector will find some ways around. It's constantly innovating through regulatory arbitrage. So you get shadow banking, you get banks connected to shadow banking. And then we start talking about two other tools then that central banks might want to employ. It may want to lean against the wind by using an interest rate policy. It's very blunt at one level to deal with financial stability, but as Jeremy Stein has highlighted in one of his speeches as the when he was the governor, that the advantage of such a blunt policy is that it affects everyone. It raises the returns to holding liquidity for all parts of the financial sector, and this can actually be a very powerful tool. The other approach is, and I think I'm going to come back to this when I discuss Dodd-Frank, is that we need to rethink how we design central banking tools, because it would be better to regulate by function rather than form. For example, just limit leverage at the level of mortgages rather than trying to regulate mortgage lenders or commercial banks. We should think about clearing houses and setting minimum margin requirements on derivatives rather than trying to design regulation that's aimed at individual institutions involved in the derivative space. Now, all of this traditional perspective ignores the fact that in practice, when central banks operate, they are constantly thinking about what is it that we can and cannot do. And this is, of course, governed by the laws in the system, in the economy, that allow it to conduct financial stability in a particular way. So let me go to slide 4. That's going to talk a little bit about this. And it's clear that the central bank not just operate these tools, such as macroprudential regulation or interest rate policy, freely in order to get that financial stability. So in particular, if certain actions are not allowed or not explicitly mentioned under the remit of the central bank, if the central bank gets into this territory, it worries that it's going to lead to certain questions in the political system. It might then lead to political interference. And therefore, a certain amount of inaction may actually be desirable because you can preserve your political independence over a longer period of time. Now, as I think was stressed quite heavily by the first speaker, I think it's natural in a democratic system that any institution that you design to solve a particular problem must have democratic accountability. So, of course, there is governance, accountability, there is transparency for the central banking system as well. But the concern that I want to raise is that the political system might want to restrict central banking scope in financial stability, so that the central bank is constantly asking this question: Should I raise interest rates? Should I actually go and try to rein in shadow banking, and maybe shy away from doing some of these things because they are afraid that such actions are in the gray zone of its remit, and then it might actually trigger political interference. So how should we design the central banking system to actually limit this sort of a problem? So let me get on to this. So let me move to slide 5. So I think I want to put on the table that maybe we need a formal political economy perspective to think about this issue. And I think the best way to think about this, at least the one that I can come up with, is that we really have a central divergence in horizons and objectives between the political system and between the central bank horizons and objectives. Political horizons, not at all points of time, but at many points of time, can become rather short-termist, and they can become quite populist. They might want to serve interests of the contingencies that they are trying to attract votes from or raise funding from. In contrast, at least on I think it's fair to say that central bank horizons can be relatively longer term and certainly less populist, given that, you know, they don't face the sort of election cycles at the same frequency and certainly not as fervently fought as the political elections are. Now, this divergence in horizons and objectives creates a potential tension, which is that every time in a crisis management, a central bank has to step in and use its balance sheet or lender of last resort to undertake certain actions that look quasi-fiscal, it can set the stage for political interference. And political system might not necessarily object the actions at the point they happen, but once these actions happen, they create the stage for actually reining in the central bank's scope for financial stability so that some of its independence can be taken out, so that it frees up the way for certain political outcomes down the road. Similarly, if a central bank tries to prevent crises in good times, for example, by raising interest rates in good time to lean against the wind, reach the dark corners of the shadow banking, keep the derivatives activity, which is happening off balance sheet, under control, try to get grips on money market funds, which basically look like a banking function, but is really happening outside the sort of standard regulatory mandate of the U.S. financial sector. But if it does all of these things, it might be that if it's not explicitly under its remit, some of these things might be politically unpopular, and then it might be prevented from undertaking these actions in good times. Now, this might happen through financial sector putting pressure on the political system, or it might happen directly through the political system because they like certain things like awarding houses to households, maintaining high house prices. Maybe that creates short-term jobs, even though that may be quite unsustainable as a way of growth in the economy in the long run. So I wanted to think about how we might limit these kinds of political headwinds. So let me move to slide 6 and 7 that talk about a possible design of the central banking institution to get around this problem. So I had four big ideas. First, I would actually be in the favor of relying on rules in the crisis management part of what the central banks do. I think it would be good for central banks and that institution in the long run shy away from quasi-fiscal actions to the extent it can. So I would actually broaden the scope of central banks. I think it should be able to do lender of last resort, not just to depository institutions, but to markets at large, should be able to keep open systemically important parts of the financial sector. But I think it should be able to ensure through a rule at each point that whoever it is channeling liquidity to is maintaining minimum solvency requirements. So what do I have in mind? Think about Lehman Brothers. The Federal Reserve probably had no choice but to extend lender of last resort to broker-dealers, Lehman Brothers, et cetera, included. But what it didn't have was actually a tool to ensure that Lehman Brothers would recapitalize itself, or that Lehman Brothers would actually pick up the offers that were coming to buy up its equity from some foreign banks. And so I think a central bank should not be trying to provide liquidity without addressing solvency. And importantly, shying away from such actions would be crucial to actually not having political interference down the road as to what its mandate should be and what it should be doing and what it should not be doing. Now, of course, if you're going to do lender of last resort at large, you can't do that without having the broad scope in good times to actually regulate the growth and leverage in shadow banking. So that's my second point, is that right at the outset, under central banking mandate should be a very broad scope of financial stability that is not limited to deposit institutions, but recognizes that shadow banking will in the end come under the scope of central banks' crisis management operations, and therefore the central bank should be able to maintain minimum solvency standards in the shadow banking right at the outset. When new innovations come about, we are proactive to keep the central keep the shadow banking in check. And in fact, I would go and say that this quote should actually cover the solvency requirements of state-owned and government-sponsored entities in the financial sector as well, given that they might also be critically important. Third, and I think this is continuing in this theme, that central banks should have a broad scope for financial stability. I think it seems to me almost a given that financial stability should be an explicit third mandate. In fact, it should be the first mandate along with the other ones, in my view, for the central banks. I think what it does is that even though central banks might have a long horizon, it just introduces an explicit long-run dimension that the central banks can appeal to while trying to defend certain actions that they would like to take for financial stability. So, for example, if house prices are going too strong, if housing activity is too excessive, then the central bank should be able to lean against the wind by raising rates and by appealing to the explicit financial stability mandate that it has. My sense is that historically the Fed might have shied away from doing this as quickly as it might have at other times, because if it's not in the explicit mandate to do such things for financial stability, it makes its case a little weaker for doing this. And if short-term jobs, short-term housing growth is politically attractive, that sets the stage for political interference into central banking independence. And the last thing, and I think this goes along the lines of what Charlie Plosser was relating to, I didn't think about it in terms of division of the Fed responsibility itself within different reserve banks. But I would actually prefer there being to a certain amount and certain extent of multiple regulatory agencies, because it limits the extent of the political system to cram down an agenda on the entire regulatory system. Now, of course, one needs to balance this need for multiplicity with the coordination need and the jurisdictional arbitrage that might arise from such a system. So just a quick words. I realize I'm out of time, but I want to just say a few quick words on what the Dodd-Frank probably did right and not do right. In my view, there were some hits and some misses in the way it was written. As I said, I'm for the limits and the restrictions on the 13th key exception, but not in exactly the way they are worded in the Dodd-Frank. So I don't think limiting targeted action for non-commercial banks is the right objective. I think targeted action against any one entity, I think, should be limited. I think central banks should be trying to keep markets open, and therefore it should lend to the system at large. And as I said, I would like that to be with minimum solvency standards. So restrictions, yes, but maybe not on specific forms of entities, but it should be to the system at large, but ensuring minimum solvency standards. Second, the Dodd-Frank creates the Financial Stability Oversight Council and SIFI designation. I view this as a very big positive. It's an attempt to maintain multiple regulators, but at the same time achieve coordination on financial stability issues. It allows the designation of non-banking entities to be systemically important. Many of them clearly are, so that's a plus. But one question mark I have here, which is, what about housing? Aren't GSEs the most systemic entities of our financial sector, and why isn't their regulation harmonized with whatever objectives are for financial stability from other parts of the financial sector? And I think putting it explicitly on the Federal Reserve mandate for financial stability would be good, in my view, because then it has a mandate to do this, because otherwise it's never going to touch it, because it's an action that's going to give rise to immediate political interference if it tried to touch housing or GSEs directly. And the last point, I was a bit disappointed that the Dodd-Frank in the end didn't put financial stability explicitly in the Federal Reserve mandate. In fact, the early drafts that were proposed for the Dodd-Frank Act did have financial stability as a third mandate, but it was inexplicably dropped from the final wording. And I'm concerned that this may be a desire in the political system to keep financial stability at bay and leave it in the gray zone of the central banking, so that when interest rates need to be kept low because boom times are looking very good, that's attractive politically, central bank feels a little less free to actually lean against the wind. So let me stop there. I think I'll go just jump to the last slide, which is, I think financial stability is key to economic growth. It's a necessary condition for much of what central banks have achieved in modern times for transmission of monetary policy. But therefore, in my opinion, it should explicitly be part of the central banking mandate. And whatever tools central banks need to maintain this, in my opinion, should be given to them in a charter, especially the time for designing it right after a crisis. So it should recognize that crisis management actions limited in terms of them looking like bailouts. They should be support for the system at large. But at the same time, central banks should be able to then restrict leverage for everyone in the financial sector. So it should have a very broad scope over shadow banking. And importantly, should be able to take tough actions and be able to defend them in good times so as ensure that short-term interests for jobs, et cetera, are not compromising long-run growth creation in the economy. I realize it's a delicate balance, but central banks often do not undertake certain actions to maintain independence. And the smaller its charter can make this set of inactions, the better it would be for financial stability, in my view. Let me stop there.
Okay, thank you, Viral. Jeremy, you with us?
Here I am.
Good.
Yes.
The floor is yours.
Okay, well, thanks, David. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here, I guess, virtually. Sorry.
There's a little bit of laughter because we put a picture of you up on the screen.
And it's a funny
but
picture.
It's not the picture of you as a gymnast, so you're okay.
Boy, thanks for that. So listen, there's a lot to like, a lot to discuss in this paper. I'm going to pick and choose. I'm going to try and say a few words about four of the issues that Viral has raised. First of these is the interplay of monetary policy and potentially time-varying macroprudential tools like capital requirements and LTV ratios. The second is the question he put quite a bit of emphasis on, which is should the Fed have an explicit financial stability mandate? Third, set of governance and accountability issues around the lender of last resort. And fourth, to what extent should it be the central bank's job to regulate the non-bank financial sector broadly defined? So I'll see if I can touch on each of those. On the first, on monetary policy and macroprudential tools, what are the respective responsibilities of these two when we have time-varying financial market conditions, hot and cold markets of various sorts? I think the conventional view here, and it's widely accepted, is you should try to do as much as you can with the macroprudential tools in an effort to take the burden off of monetary policy. So this is the idea, and it's oft repeated, that monetary policy is too blunt, and you don't want to impact the aggregate economy in an effort to contend with risks that are emerging in just some segments of asset markets. So, for example, if, say, housing markets are booming, you might want to use time-varying LTV requirements. Or if banks are lending very aggressively in a particular area, C&I, commercial real estate, you could imagine time-varying capital requirements. Indeed, you might want to have a committee that meets regularly to do something like this, as the Bank of England's Financial Policy Committee does. So let me start by saying I don't disagree with any of this. I think the conventional economic argument makes a lot of sense. But I think in the spirit of this conference, I think this approach does raise some relatively delicate political economy issues, and these may be more challenging in some countries than others. So when I think about the case for Fed independence, particularly in terms of its monetary policy function, I think of it as being built on two pillars, which is on the one hand, you're trying to solve a time consistency problem, which is why independence is valuable, and monetary policy is not too fiscal, which is why independence is not too problematic. And not being fiscal, in turn, has two elements to it. First is that taxpayer loss exposure is minimized, and second, redistributive or allocative consequences are also relatively minimal. So that's why it seems to make sense to me that as compared to monetary policy, the regulatory rulemaking process inside the Fed is much more consultative, much more open, there's much more public comment, and it's much more slow-moving. So I think given that, there's a tension. If you want to make high-frequency policy changes in capital or LTV requirements, after you've spent a couple of years writing the rule, seeking public comment, it's a little weird to think about then turning that dial on a discretionary basis at high frequency, precisely because you're getting into sort of a more redistributive area. So if you couch it that way, you know, the bluntness of monetary policy, while it's undesirable from a purely economic perspective, may actually be somewhat desirable from a political economy one. So if you lean against an incipient overheating by tightening bank capital and you do so strongly enough to make a difference, you know, you're hurting the banks at the expense of the shadow banks, and you're hurting bank-dependent borrowers at the expense of those who can go to the capital markets. So as a matter of economic policy, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it may be more fiscal in nature and hence more challenging to do without an open public discussion. Whereas if you raise rates, the bluntness means its broader brush and its impact and may be more easily delegated, therefore, to an independent central bank. So this is all in the spirit of a second-best political economy argument, which suggests that there's some scope for monetary policy to carry some of the weight, I think. So now, having said all of this, I'm going to say something that may sound a little bit contradictory, which is, and I think I'm going to sort of disagree with Viral here, insofar as monetary policy specifically goes, I don't think I would want to have a separate financial stability objective. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean that monetary policy shouldn't be attending to issues of financial stability. But if you think really of the Fed's objective function, which we now think of as kind of a loss function around deviations of unemployment and inflation from their targets, I wouldn't want to have a third item in the loss function. I think the right way to think about the issues here is to think about the fact that you care about unemployment and inflation, but very importantly, you care about them over time. So if financial stability creates problems, so if an overheated credit market, let's say, is going to lead to some kind of a reversal and some kind of damage further that down the road, that goes insofar as it affects unemployment and inflation. And I think there's a lot of valuable discipline in nesting it that way. I think if you have a third leg in the mandate, it's very hard to know what weight you put on it. In other words, if unemployment is away from target and you have a tension between these two things, how much do you favor the financial stability leg of the mandate? I think if you model it in this kind of more intertemporal way, the weights emerge naturally, and you'll naturally have sensible conclusions such as you put less weight on financial stability when unemployment is far from target, and it starts to loom more heavily when unemployment gets closer to target. So there's a discipline there which I think is valuable and which I wouldn't want to lose, and it puts the burden on people like me who actually want to make the empirical case that financial market froth can matter for future real activity, but we have to make that case affirmatively, and I think that's how it should be. Let me say a few things briefly about lender of last resort, which is really sort of a very difficult and completely central issue. I mean, that's why we have central banks at some level. And at the same time, in a crisis, there's inevitably some degree of fiscal exposure. So there's sort of a straightforward tension. I mean, my model for this is pretty straightforward. I would make being under the regulatory umbrella an absolute prerequisite for access to the discount window. If you can't regulate them ex ante and you can't govern the moral hazard problem and you don't know the firm to whom you're lending, I think it's very difficult from a sort of governance perspective to do lender of last resort. Now, having said that, given that the Fed now does regulate the largest broker-dealer firms and subjects them to the same stress testing regime as it does the banks, I believe, as I know, was talked about in a Wall Street Journal op-ed this morning, I believe Dodd-Frank may have gone too far in erecting impediments to the access of broker-dealer firms to the discount window. So I would have been inclined to treat regulated depositories and regulated broker-dealers more symmetrically on the back end with respect to the lender of last resort, to the extent that I could treat them symmetrically ex ante, that is to say, with respect to the rules of the game. On that point, you know, of course, I agree that there should be rules. There are some subtle issues about whether the rules of the sort that Viral discusses are bright line rules that Congress puts down, or rules that essentially state Congress's intent, but that leave some room for judgmental interpretation based on the facts of the case. So I think there's I think there's more to be said about the issue of what does it exactly mean to have a set of congressionally specified rules for the lender of last resort. And finally, a couple words about the central bank and the shadow banking system. I think Viral is completely on target when he emphasizes the pervasiveness of regulatory arbitrage and the corresponding importance of paying close attention to the shadow banking system. Here, I think the only issue we're thinking hard about, the only issue that's really difficult, is how does one divide up the responsibility among the different agencies. So consistent with Viral, I think the Fed is clearly going to play an important role in many cases, but in my view, it's not obvious that you always want to have the Fed in the lead on every one of the shadow banking type of issues. So let me just give a concrete example. Suppose you're concerned about the growth of the asset management business, and in particular, you're concerned about open-end bond and loan funds that invest in illiquid credit assets. And, you know, you worry that something disorderly could happen, some kind of sharp widening of spreads or something like that that could damage the real economy. Let's take that as a given. So suppose you have that worry, and suppose you want to entertain a policy to address this issue. So, for example, you might want to think about the prospect of imposing exit fees on withdrawals from these bond funds to mitigate run incentives. Now, suppose this is the SEC's turf. And suppose, just for the sake of discussion, it's something that they're not inclined to be forward-leaning on. And maybe the FSOC process is not having the kind of impact you might have hoped for. Question is the answer to say, you know, this is frustrating and I wish the Fed had jurisdiction over this? And, you know, there maybe the Fed is better situated to take into account systemic externalities. My instinct here is no. I wouldn't want to just keep piling these sorts of responsibilities onto the Fed. I mean, there's a variety of reasons, some of which Viral has alluded to. My view is that, you know, if that's your diagnosis of the problem, I think the right move from an overall design of institutions perspective is that you need to work to strengthen both the mandate and the culture of the SEC so that they are better able to internalize the sorts of systemic considerations that you're concerned about. I know that Don Cohn is there, and I know that he's spoken at some length about some of these issues. And basically, you know, I've read what he said, and I basically find myself in agreement with a lot of that. So let me stop there.
Okay, thank you very much, Viral and Jeremy. I'm going to get us caught up back on schedule. So I'm going to ask Don Cohn in a moment to respond to some of this, and then we're going to bring the panel up because I think some of the issues that are raised by Viral and Jeremy are well suited to the panel, and it seems better to have the in-person discussion than try and do this remotely. But Don Cohn, who's as I said, is on the Financial Policy Committee of the Bank of England, which doesn't apparently require you to be a citizen to make policy there. That's one thing. I don't know how Peter Brown would deal with that. Don, Viral says two things that I'm interested in your reaction. One is he says that the Fed should have more rules for how it acts in a crisis because that'll make it more politically acceptable. And I wondered, is that practical? Jeremy referred to this. And secondly, do you worry about giving the Fed ever more financial stability responsibilities and it becomes the kind of uber regulator of everything that has a dollar sign next to it?
Right. So I think on the first one, I'm skeptical that you can set out, like, I agree with Jeremy. I agree with Jeremy on the rules situation. I think it would be very, very difficult to set out a set of rules that would restrict behavior in a meaningful sense ex ante beyond what the law, pointing now to Parney, beyond what the law has already done. I do think because every crisis is different, every situation you're facing is different, and what you need to do is not going to be easily spelled out by rules. So I do think the Fed was under Dodd-Frank, the Fed was required to talk about what it would do on 13.3. It did kind of a minimal job. I was hoping that it would take that opportunity to spell out more proactively about why this kind of lending was necessary. I agree with Jeremy that it ought to be to institutions that are already supervised to deal with the moral hazard and the broker-dealers, subs of the bank holding companies might be the first in line for that kind of thing. But I think the Fed could have done a better job talking about how it would use 13.3, but I think rules in any constrictive sense would be very, very hard.
Too much? Is it too much? Are we asking the Fed to do too much?
I think if we gave, again, as Jeremy said at the end, I don't think putting all this in the Fed I think it would be a lot to put all the shadow banking regulation in the Fed. And I think my first preference, as he said, would be to change the way the SEC does business and the CFTC. So give them a financial stability mandate. There are institutions that need financial stability mandates in their legislation, and work to make the institution rather than the chair of the organization part of FSOC, see whether you could come up with a better way of making decisions and imbuing those institutions with financial stability rather than the protection of investors, not instead of, but in addition to the protection of investors and guarding the funds of the people who put stuff in there. Can I make one more comment?
Please.
This countercyclical macroprudential and the allocative aspects of that. So we had an interesting situation on the Financial Policy Committee. The government asked us what tools we wanted as macroprudential regulators. And when the committee was initially formed, we asked for countercyclical capital. We asked for sectoral, the ability to raise and lower capital requirements on the real estate, particular sectors that might be having problems. We didn't ask for LTV, LTI type of regulations for home mortgages initially because we were concerned about the political blowback on that, and the fact that it did have a big allocative, could have an allocative aspect. I was uncomfortable because I recognized that the high LTVs and high LTIs, loan-to-income, debt-to-income ratios, were a major contributor to the problem in the United States, but I recognized the political problems. Well, there has been some discussion. The Chancellor of the Exchequer invited us to ask again, and we have asked for LTVs and LTIs, but I think it's important that the elected person, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, asked us to think again about whether we wanted these things, and we have requested them. So there has been some political dimension. We acted to rein in some potential deterioration in credit allocation, in last June. I was pleasantly surprised at how little political blowback there was. I think we trailed it well. We advertised what we were doing, why we were doing it. It was insurance. It wasn't intended to take people out of loans they could have gotten. They could have then gotten. It was just to prevent a deterioration. So I think it is possible to run countercyclical macroprudential policy in a democracy, but it does require the right dialogue with the elected representatives.
Thank you for that. Can I ask the panelists to come up here and take these four seats closest to me, and I'll introduce them as they come up. Jeremy and Viral, if you'd like to stay on the line and participate, feel free, but if just interrupt if you'd like to, but if you can't, I understand that. So one of our goals here today is to think about the relationship between Congress and the Federal Reserve. After all, the Fed is a creature of Congress and has to be held accountable to Congress. I'm joined here by a really distinguished panel. Sarah Binder is a senior fellow here in the Governance Studies Unit of Brookings and a professor at George Washington University and has written a lot about the relationship between Fed and Congress over the years. Ben Bernanke, distinguished senior fellow in residence in Brookings, and of course the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ruth Porat, who is the chief financial officer of Morgan Stanley and happens to be a member of the advisory council of the Hutchin Center, and Barney Frank, who I'm tempted to say needs no introduction, but I heard somebody do that once, and Barney once said, just for once, I'd like to hear the introduction that people don't think I need, so I don't want to get that. Barney Frank is the former chairman of the House Financial Services Committee and was God's gift to financial and economic reporters. He wasn't always very nice to us, but he always had just the absolute perfect quote. And for that alone, we miss him, as well as his other contributions. I'm not sure he misses Washington.
Yeah, you weren't always very nice to us, so I thought we did.
Sarah, maybe I can start with you, if I may. So there seems to be a lot of animosity between Congress and the Fed these days. Some people in this room think that the Fed saved us from the second Great Depression, but at least some members of Congress don't seem to think that worked out very well. How do you account for what's going on the Hill now? Is it unusual, or is it just, you know, another episode in partisan argument?
So I put it to a mix of policy and a mix of politics, and it's always hard to separate the two of those on Capitol Hill. First and foremost, congressional attention to the Fed tends to be countercyclical. Right? The economy's doing well. Congress really doesn't pay much attention. The economy falters in a big way. It's not surprising that Congress wants to return to the Federal Reserve Act, perhaps to fix the problem, perhaps to find someone to blame. So certainly the rise of the financial crisis and economic crisis rejiggered and opened up congressional eyes to trying to look at the Federal Reserve Act again. But a second, I think what's really important here as well is to think about this particular crisis and what the policy response was. When interest rates hit zero, you have to turn, as I've learned, to unconventional monetary policies. And that potentially crosses the boundaries, as the previous panel was talking about, right, between monetary and fiscal policy. And it seems to the public and perhaps to lawmakers, it seems that the Fed might be in the position of choosing winners and losers, whether it's with 13-3 or with large-scale asset purchases, right? And that triggers congressional attention. And then finally, of course, right, we're in a period of intense partisan polarization, whether that's ideological or just partisanship. And it seeps. It has no boundaries in Washington, I think, as anyone who might have watched the Yellen hearing last week, right? And so House members, they hear voter anger. They gin up voter anger, I think. And there's concern about whether or not the Fed deserves the type of independence and the lack of scrutiny that it often has enjoyed.
Mr. Frank, is this time different, or is this just another series and why?
It's different. Look, there's an inherent tension. I was struck that during the earlier part of that I was able to get, I had plane trouble too. Populist was always a bad word. When you're in an atmosphere in which people suggest that worrying about public opinion is a negative, you're going to have some tension. Beyond that, though, I think this is different for reasons a lot else is different. There was a greater philosophical gap in Washington today than there has been in a very long time. I think you have to go back to the Civil War to see it. And that is the fact that the Republican Party has moved to a much more coherent, intellectual, ideological position. And obviously everybody in office is looking to start voters. But I, as vehemently as I disagree with many of these people, I can tell you they are very sincere. This is what they believe. And I think the root of the issue at this point, I guess I can sum it up in two words, Humphrey and Hawkins. What you have on the part of the dominant forces in the Republican Party today is a vehement objection to the dual mandate. That's really what's at issue. I think many Republicans do understand that the atmospherics of repealing the unemployment part of the mandate would be very bad, but they are opposed to it ideologically and philosophically. They resent it, and I believe that is at the root of the problem. That's what the objection to quantitative easing is. It is not that they are abusing their mandate, frankly, but that they are carrying it out, and I think that's the issue. And the other thing I would say is people should not underestimate in terms of public reaction. And I, you know, with the death of Robert Ben-Moshe, who'd done such a good job, of course, I have never feared for the stability of the United States in all the time I've been working on this business, except in that period in 2009 when the AIG bonuses were announced. I mean, it was like one of those scenes from a bad Frankenstein movie. They were out there with the pitchforks and the torches. There was a degree of anger. I really feared for our capacity to govern. I did a couple of dumb things because of it. I particularly struck now that Mr. Greenberg is suing the federal government over this. The only way I can describe it is that the arsonist is suing the fire department for water damage. But the anger that was there was so deep-rooted. But it is not just, it is very fundamental. There was an objection to this whole notion of the dual mandate. And that, I think, makes this more than just a personal thing. There is the deepest philosophical difference that I can recall being argued out here. The Fed is in the crosshairs.
Mr. Bernanke, one of the points that was made in Peter Conte's Brown paper was that we ought to think about a different way to govern the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve Bank presidents are somehow an 80-year-old atavism that we ought to take out. You missed this, Mr. Frank. He referred to the Reserve Bank presidents as the gallbladder of the American economy and said maybe we should do surgery. So there's a trade-off here between the assets of having a decentralized intelligence gathering and a rather unusual form of appointment of the presidents. Do you think we need to change this system?
Well, I disagree that the way they're selected is the source of all the anger. I really don't think that's important. I think that, as Charlie Plosser said, I think that for many people, their local reserve bank is the friendly face of the Fed, and they do have excellent community relationships and relationships with leaders in the business community and so on. And I'm sure Barney will confirm that that was an important factor in the politics around Dodd-Frank. So the question is, again, to quote Barney, the Henny Youngman principle compared to what? What's the alternative? Now, I guess that Mr. Brown would like to see presidential appointments and Senate confirmations. I don't think that, well, I mean, as a practical matter, the Board of Governors has been operating basically on about two-thirds capacity, you know, for the last 10 years because of the problems with the confirmation process. And I also wonder whether the general public would feel more confident in the Fed because the Congress is more engaged in the selection of local Reserve Bank presidents. This is a soundtrack.
I don't think it's yours. I think
it's coming from there.
Sorry. Don't do away with
me.
Yeah.
Electronic sleuths.
So this is why we need Federal Reserve Bank presidents.
So I recognize the issue. I don't think it's at the heart of the political problems right now, but a direction that might be worth thinking about, and I have not explored this and I'm not making recommendations, but maybe there's a way to get broader input and participation, but still have a sense that, you know, the local area is making this decision as opposed to Washington making the decision.
Mr. Frank, you once talked about changing this.
Yeah, as I understand the paper, it was not, the Senate confirmation was not his preferred choice.
Right.
His preferred choice was a substantial diminution of their independence. I did file a bill at one point saying that they should just not have a vote on the FOMC. I do believe there is no way you can justify under the American Constitution these private citizens making it. My guess is it survived only because it would be very hard to find someone with standing to bring the case. And I was told, I raised that with Alan Greenspan, who said, well, you couldn't get people to take the job if they didn't have a vote on the FOMC. I don't know, Mr. Foster, if that is accurate. My answer is, yeah, my general view, if I'm appointing people, is if they think they're doing me such a big favor, I probably don't want them around, but because it just distorts all the incentives. But from the impact, after all, only five of them any one time have it. Much of the time, people don't have it. I would say leave them participating in the debate, draw on the research, but take the vote away. Now, I understand that it's a problem with regard to the confirmation, but it exacerbates the problem. I think the paper pointed out that the norm now is for the bank presidents to be the majority on the FOMC, and they are appointed more by bankers than anybody else. That's just, that's a bit of it. So my response would be, what I propose, was they not do that. The other thing we did do in the legislation, we tried to be very careful where we were giving increased powers. They went to the Board of Governors, not to the regional banks. We did not, we quite explicitly, I do remember that. I don't remember, I will tell you, I have no idea what happened to financial stability in the mandate. I talked to Gene Roslanowicz, who had my institutional memory. We don't remember it. I would say in defense, to get to this point, that legislation which has one of its major pieces, the creation of a Financial Stability Oversight Council, has some defense against the argument that we ignored financial stability and have given the Fed a whole lot of its job there. But I do think that if it did come up, it was what Jeremy Stein suggested, a fear of dilution of the two existing mandates and maybe a reluctance to get into the ideological battle of the dual mandate once you throw a third mandate in there, and we had enough to fight about.
Ms. Pratt, one of the features of Dodd-Frank is I think that there was concern that the Fed had gone too far in some of the bailouts, that the Fed had too much leeway in making these calls. And so the law limited some the power of the Fed a bit, limited some the power of the FDIC. When you look at this from your point of view, from the banking point of view, have we put managers of financial stability in a straitjacket here? Do they have enough freedom to fight the next crisis, do you think?
I believe they do. I think that when I look at the biggest assault on financial stability back in 2008, it was really the speed of collapse of these institutions. And there were two terms that were used quite a bit back in 08, which was the weekend event and too big to fail. And to me, the biggest risk was really this weekend event, the fact that in 24 hours, 48 hours, we saw the collapse of major institutions. And when you're collapsing that quickly, there's no time to look for self-help, to adjust, to do any sort of risk mitigation. What you do is you look for some sort of a bailout. I should turn this way. You look for some sort of a bailout, and that puts the taxpayers at risk. So what was really needed is what both Dodd-Frank and the Federal Reserve and Basel have done, which is put in place a very comprehensive system that addresses, I think, head-on this risk of the weekend event. And it has three components to it. And the starting point is we needed to strengthen institutions in a business-as-usual sense, which means higher capital. It means all of the capital stress testing and CCAR. It means more liquidity, the liquidity stress testing and CLAR, and all of the changes in activities that came out of Dodd-Frank. It required, to me, one of the most important things was this notion of what I call extending the runway. Provide more time so institutions don't fail overnight in 24, 48 hours, but you extend the runway. And finally, at the end of last year, we had the rule codified that went to a long-term measure of liquidity. I mean, go back to 08. The discussion was liquidity is oxygen for a financial institution. I believe that to my core. And so finally, we now have terms around what's called the net stable funding ratio, a one-year measure of liquidity. That coupled with, again, coming out of Dodd-Frank, the resolution planning, recovery planning. Let me start with that. Recovery planning, which I think was so critical. There's more talk about resolution than recovery. But recovery, you're more likely to hit, than a need for resolution. So that recovery.
Define the term.
So recovery plan is what's the playbook for an institution if you find yourself under stress? What are you going to do? What is the self-help? What are the steps that you're going to take, in my words, to extend the runway? And you have a recovery plan before you get to, you know what, if that doesn't work, then you bury yourself. Then you have a resolution plan. That's part three. And finally, at the end of last year, final codification of what is the amount of securities that need to get bailed in came. So I think we now, in the aggregate, have a much more robust system. And that doesn't, and at this point, I would say the most important thing is to digest and assess these rules. We've probably overshot in some areas and undershot in others, but it's been such a fundamental transformation. And so I would agree with some of the prior speakers who said that's one part of the equation, but we also need to think about shadow banking and what's moved outside of the regulated world. Again, a core part of Dodd-Frank, in my view, is derivatives reform. But one of the potential unintended consequences is much of this risk is moving outside of the regulated world to clearinghouses. Let's make sure we don't have the next crisis. So rather than just focusing on the last one, let's now focus on the next one. And what I'll just add is, you know, and then what are the ticking time bombs out there that could come from anywhere?
Fannie Freddie were ticking time bombs. I would suggest that in student lending, we have another ticking time bomb. It's $1.3 trillion program, just like Fannie Freddie. It's a socially well-intentioned program, but I would suggest by its design and execution is going to hurt those it's intended to help, and the taxpayers are going to be left holding the bill. So it's a broad answer to your question, but I do think that for financial stability, we need to start with the regulated world and then think about where the other sources of risk are.
Would you put autos? Are you worried about autos?
Auto lending?
Auto lending, not as much as student lending, but I think that, again, any place where credit is mispriced or there's a risk of mispricing credit, it's problematic. And my concern on student lending is this notion that I agree with, that education is a passport to social and economic mobility, no question about it. But that presumes you get a degree. And we have 68% of kids going to for-profit colleges who don't have a degree. So they have no degree and all the debt. That's why I put that one high up on the list. It's just a well-intentioned program that's gone astray.
Mr. Bernanke, do you think that the Fed and the FDIC have enough power to avoid a repeat of Lehman Weekend? Or where would you like to see more or less constraints?
Well, I think that a really important part of Dodd-Frank was the resolution authority, the orderly liquidation authority. And that took the Fed out of AIG weekend type situations, which was really good for the Fed and it's good for the country and gives a bunch of tools which are still not perfect, still have not been completely worked out internationally, et cetera, but it's certainly already much better than what we had in 2008. And so I'm glad the Fed is out of that. I think on the margin that other changes that were made pulled back a little bit on the flexibility the Fed had, and others as well. You know, for example, the provision that the FDIC's bond guarantee authority requires the congressional approval and tightening up the collateral requirement on the Fed and things of that sort. I think on the margin, those things are a bit of a problem. I guess the one I would mention, which is totally understandable, one of the big conflicts, and this is a political economy issue, is that in a lender of last resort situation, institutions will not borrow if they think that they're going to be disclosed. And the good compromise was a two-year lag. I would have gone for three or four, but anyway, that's one of those trade-offs that you have. So I think in general that, you know, that we still do have the authorities. I think there is a problem. We talked, Viral talked about rules, and rules are important for setting expectations and for creating legitimacy, et cetera. The problem is, as Don mentioned, is that financial crises tend to have a certain chaotic element to them. And the Constitution gives the president considerable flexibility to respond to military situations, for example, because of that very thing. And I'm sure it's not politically possible, but it would be worth thinking about to give the president some ability to declare emergencies or take, you know, extraordinary actions and not put that all on the Fed.
First, I want to say when Ben talks about the resolution authority and finds it reasonable, let me say I'm not surprised that he thinks it's a good idea because he and Paulson were the ones who came to us and said this is what you have to do. And I think that has not been as widely understood. This is, let me mention a word not often heard around today. The process by which we responded in 2008 to the crisis and went on to drafting the legislation was as bipartisan an effort as Congress has ever engaged in peacetime, which included Bush appointees, both Ben, Sheila Barrett, some others, but in that whole framework. The other point I would make is with regard to the problem with the institutions, I think you have to separate out two issues with the failures. One is, and this is the one that we felt was a public responsibility, how do you prevent the negative consequences of an institution that owes a lot of people a lot of money not being able to pay any of them and causing that serious ripple effect? I think that one we've resolved pretty well. What we do is to say that the institution may well go out of business, and that's fine. But I think that one, and it was again, I mean, as I recall, Ben and Hank Paulson said to us, with Lehman and AIG, they had a problem under the law, that they had two choices. They could pay none of the debts or all of the debts, and each one was criticized. And what we gave them was the ability, the regulators, to pay only as much of the debt as was needed to prevent a further kind of cataclysm with the money recovered from other financial institutions.
Harbinder, do you think all this uproar about the Fed is going to go away as the unemployment rate keeps falling? Or do you think that we're going to end up with some legislation that will significantly change the governance or the authority of the Fed?
I think the question here is, I don't think the problems are going away. I think as the Fed and FSOC tries to implement the expanded mandates under Dodd-Frank, that the questions of transparency, the questions of accountability, I'm hard-pressed to see those resolving, even as the economy improves. Right? Surely the economy improving will help. But I think in the regulatory and supervision side, those problems really aren't going away. The question, I guess, for Congress is, does it have the capacity to legislate, and is there, right, some kernel of agreement between the parties? And as last week's episode showed us, we tend to underestimate the differences between the House and the Senate, right? And the question is there a common interest between the two chambers, and is there bipartisanship at all in the Senate over a set of issues?
So the answer is no, you don't expect much to pass.
Can I just say, there's a second, and that conflict that we just talked about, here's the deal that Sarah talked about. There is a conflict, and this you're going to see played out to some extent within the Republican Party, which is where a lot of the energy is today. There is this conflict. You see it on XM. You're going to see it on trade, and you see it very much on the Fed. There is a conflict between the more traditional mainstream conservative business wing of the Republican Party and the more energized Tea Party wing. And that's, I do not see that ending, but that, you know, that could even well play out. I think for the first time in a long time, the Fed is going to be an issue in a presidential nomination contest, because it is a very serious issue that divides the two major factions in the Republican Party.
We got a little attention the last time around, as I recall. Rick Perry had some suggestions for Ben Bernanke.
But Rick Perry didn't get much attention. I mean, it's serious. But you're right. But I think it's going to be even more serious at this point. But I think what you'll see, I'll make a prediction, if the Republicans were to win the presidency, the House, and the Senate, they will be under great self-generated and external pressure to repeal the unemployment part of the mandate. And I continue to believe that it is profound fundamental disagreement with that second section of the mandate that is driving a lot of this.
Ben Bernanke, would it make a difference if we had a single mandate with price stability as the only goal?
It would make a difference under some circumstances, but it wouldn't have made much difference over the last few years. The Fed did three rounds of quantitative easing and zero rates and forward guidance and all those things, and the inflation rate is still below target.
Right.
So it would be hard to argue that the Fed could have not done those things. Of course, there would be circumstances when the two conflict. I think that in practice, if you look at the Bank of England, for example, and other inflation targeters, that they do take into account economic conditions. I don't think it's as stark a difference as you would think, but there would be circumstances, I think, in which it would make a difference to policy, sure.
Ms. Pratt, do people on Wall Street care about this argument about accountability and auditing the Fed and governance, or is this just a sideshow to the more important issues like, are we going to ever get out of this bad economy?
It's a serious issue, because the notion of politicizing the Fed, for all the reasons I think articulated this morning, are spot on. The inability to actually come up with a budget deficit and to take the country to the brink as often as we did, problematic to do that with monetary policy. I think we need to have monetary policy as protected as it has been. I think elements of transparency that have increased over time under Ben Bernanke's leadership have been critically important. But yes, it's important, because what we need is a well-functioning market and a well-functioning economy for us to play the role that banks do.
Ben Bernanke, how good a job does Congress do at holding the Fed accountable?
We hold ourselves accountable, I think, pretty well. I mean, the dual mandate has gotten enormous attention, and we've added a lot of transparency, as you know, in terms of projections, in terms of press conferences, and the things that existed already, like the Humphrey Hawkins testimonies. And so the Fed is all about explaining, where the economy is and where I think the economy is going and what needs to be done to meet those mandates. So I don't think that Congress has a problem. I don't think that Congress has failed to make the Fed accountable on those grounds. What the Congress objects to, I gather, is some of the tools that have been used.
I agree with Ben that, in fact, with a lot of people in power, it wouldn't make a difference if you explicitly set unemployment or not. But you have people who, in fact, would like to structure the institution so that it did not pay that much attention to unemployment. And the argument would not be, well, why shouldn't we do there's no monetary policy argument against quantitative easing because inflation is still low. But that kind of would be, yeah, but if you were only looking at price stability, there'd be no reason to do it, that you're doing it apart because Janet, you were explicit. So they would say the whole fact that we had quantitative easing owes a good deal of its justification to concern about unemployment. And there are people who would, and I agree with you, they'd probably be that concerned anyway, but they think that if they got rid of the mandate, they could deal with it. But I also want to go back, and this is philosophical, much more than, and you say, again, this is not just vote-getting. These are people who deeply believe in it. Ron Paul was one of the most genuine men of integrity around. He believed everything he said. But here's the issue with regard to the whole accountability thing is being used. It's a proxy for making the Fed pay less attention to unemployment because people think that it's too much government intervention and potentially too inflationary. And here's the argument. We did, as Ben said, in the legislation and through some things that the Fed did unilaterally, we have created complete transparency. For example, there was a lot of argument, if you go back during AIG and Bear Stearns and others, well, who were they making deals with? There was one part of the conspiracy theory was that the Fed people were doing favors. They were making financial deals with friends of theirs. I believe it's the case, Ben and Donna here, that there is no transaction the Fed can have with a private entity that will not at some point be made public, which was a very important safeguard against it. As Ben said, in some cases, there's a two-year lag, so it doesn't affect trading on that issue. But that's a very explicit policy. No Fed transaction with any private entity will remain secret forever, and they know that. There is the controversy over auditing comes down to one issue because everything else is pretty well audited, and that is the monetary policy making. And what you have are people who want to be able to put pressure on the FOMC not to be so concerned about unemployment, to be for tighter monetary policy. And in effect, to get to a single mandate, Ben, you say, well, a lot of people wouldn't do that anyway. But I believe that, from my immersion, that's what's driving it. There is a philosophical view that says the Fed is doing much too much about unemployment. It's doing much too much in that sort of soft area. And we want a Fed that deals only with monetary policy and that is pretty tough about it. And that's at the root of the audit thing. The audit claim is not – nobody thinks – you're pocketing money, or Janet is. There was a time that you were helping your friends. I think we've dealt with that. The audit concern is part of this argument that you're doing too much. You're too activist. You're too Keynesian, and they got to stop it.
Ben Bernanke, another alternative, another piece of legislation would require the Fed to disclose how it is making policy relative to the Taylor rule. John Taylor's here. That's a formula that includes the output gap, which is kind of like unemployment, and an inflation target. Do you think that would change anything? Do you think that would be a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, I don't know I don't think the legislation, John can correct me, I don't think it specifies the Taylor rule. I would argue the Fed has already done it. The Fed put out a policy statement which provided both its objectives and its objective function, and it supports that with forecasts, projections, including projections of interest rates. So I think within a reasonable range that has already been done. I don't think you can get much more precise than that because you can't deal with the uncertainties and the many special factors that occur, in actual policymaking. In particular, as John understands, the Taylor rule would have been not very helpful in thinking about quantitative easing and the zero bound and financial stability impact on the economy and things like that happened over the last few years.
And I think we should turn to some
questions. One last question.
Yeah. Raise your hand if you have a question.
One confession, because one sort of long-standing argument I had with Ben, but it wasn't that long-standing because he convinced me. I was nervous about the notion of inflation targeting and the 2%, and I will confess it was because historically that had been used as a kind of a restraining factor on the economy. And Ben convinced me that he did not intend to do it that way, and I think the way it has worked out, that kind of 2% has actually made me happier than almost every Republican, or at least the Tea Party guys. But I think that's that kind of flexibility was very helpful.
Thank you. There was a question, John Hilsenrath there.
Hi, John Hilsenrath from the Wall Street Journal. I had a couple questions directly for Congressman Frank.
Okay, that's two questions.
Okay, so the first one is about the law that bears your name requires the executive branch to nominate a vice chair for supervision at the Fed and for the Senate to confirm that person. We're more than 4 years past the passage of the law, and there's never been a nomination. I was wondering if you think that's a problem and how that plays into the discussion we're having about accountability today for the Fed. The second one is about this point that David raises about the Taylor rule. You say the congressional Republicans want a single mandate, but a Taylor rule inherently looks at both sides of the Fed's mandate. So doesn't that contradict the argument that you're
no,
making?
No, I didn't say the Republicans wanted the Taylor rule. I tell you in terms of what the Republicans want. I mean, Ed Royce, a high-ranking member, filed the bill to repeal the unemployment part of the mandate. And I tell you, it's a fact. A large number of the Republicans in the House Financial Services Committee would have liked to repeal it, but I think we're told by the leadership, look, we got enough problems. We're not going to go out there and explicitly say we don't want anybody worried about unemployment. So the House Republicans and the Taylor rule are somewhat distinct in this regard, and there is without question, objection on philosophical grounds. And by the way, you know, the dual mandate was not there from the beginning. And I acknowledge it came from Hubert Humphrey and Gus Hawkins. It didn't come from Hayek and von Mises. I understand what their concern is. So, there's no contradiction at all in noting the fact that there is great opposition. And I believe if you look at the objections to quantitative easing, every stated objection has been disproven. The unstated objection is what the hell is the Fed doing worrying so much about unemployment and distorting its focus on just keeping inflation down. As to the first point, no, I don't think the failure to designate a vice chairman in charge of regulation in the bill that they all voted against is any reason why the Republicans are upset about what's going on. A, they didn't like the regulation, and B, they wouldn't like the vice chairman. I mean, I literally think, I don't know why they didn't do it, why they haven't appointed it. I think de facto it's in place. My guess is
Dan Tarullo does it.
Yeah, with Dan Tarullo. My guess is that what you have is the people in the administration decided a couple years ago that one of the worst things in the world was to try to get somebody confirmed and therefore weren't going to do any confirmation that wasn't necessary. Whether or not that might have changed when the filibuster thing was broken, but now it's too late for that. But I yes, we did it. I thought it was a good idea, but not a terribly important one. And I don't think that there is any practical consequence in the fact that that it hasn't been designated, nor do I think that, frankly, I think if you asked a lot of my colleagues who were very upset about what's going on with the Fed, they wouldn't remember that we named a vice chairman for regulation.
Alice Rivlin?
I wanted to ask how deflation plays into all of this. If it turns out that, in fact, over the next few years, we don't have a tendency toward inflation, we have a tendency toward deflation, does this Republican concern about too much emphasis on unemployment would seem to go away? But how do they feel about deflation?
Oh, I think that they think the fear of it is exaggerated. And, you know, I have not been in intimate contact with many of these people for 4 years now, but three. But I will say this. I'm just judging. I do not think that what you're saying is, will not the fact of deflation being much more serious a potential problem than inflation affect them. And I think you were talking, and I don't mean this in to denigrate, you were talking here about a deep philosophical principle that will not easily be changed by short-term fact patterns. And I think that's basically what it is. And you've seen that already, because I think if somebody were to do, and I wish the media would do more of this, I think they don't hold us accountable enough for people, particularly who make predictions of gloom and doom. 2 years later, you know, tell me what happened. I think people get away with predicting bad things, and the media does not go back and say, look what they said was going to happen. It didn't happen. And I think that's been the case. And as I look at the debate over quantitative easing, virtually every substantive argument that was made by the political community has fallen flat, but that has not diminished the volume of the complaints.
Want to add to that, Ben?
No, I agree with that.
It's unusual, though, to have a political system demanding that the central bank have easier credit. Isn't it usually the other way around? I mean, tighter credit.
Yeah, no, it's backwards. In the 19th century, populists were all in favor of inflation, and now they're in favor, apparently, of deflation. So I don't know exactly. I don't think you can explain this. Barney will certainly correct me. I think this is less interest and more ideology. I mean, I think from an interest perspective, why would you want to get rid of the unemployment part of the mandate? But from an ideology perspective, you might believe that, central banks are about price stability only.
This is a deep, coherent mindset. I wasn't kidding when I mentioned Hayek and von Mises. These are people who really believe that government is the greatest threat to our freedom. And one of the Republicans who left, Thad McCarter, but a very honest guy, gave a great major speech during the time of AIG and Lehman, and he said, look, it may be, or, no, I think it was over Bear Stearns, it may be that this is necessary to prevent a cataclysm, but that's the price we will pay for freedom. And I think you are talking here about this. The Fed is, it's not policy specific. It's based on this worldview.
In the blue tie, stand up, so.
Hi, my name is Jan Zidon, and I'm a visiting scholar from Finland and working the CTR think tank. This event has mainly focused on U.S. internal politics, but Fed has also very global aspect since U.S. dollars used in the world trade. What would be the consequences for U.S. economy if another currency would take over dollar as the world currency? And my second question is, in terms of information war, is there an attempt by foreign powers to undermine the Fed and create mistrust among the public? Is this a future risk for Fed, and how does Fed confront this attempt?
Try that, Ben.
Well, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about the dollar being displaced, and it's not looking very like a real near-term issue right now. The effects, the economic effects of the dollar being the world currency are very complicated. It probably lowers U.S. interest rates. It probably strengthens the dollar, which is not great for our net export position. But again, I think it's a hypothetical at this point. There has been foreign criticism of Fed policies at various times, including the quantitative easing, for example, for a variety of reasons, including concerns about spillovers, and just for ideological reasons in some cases. And I don't want to, I guess I could take the rest of the time to talk about the substance of those criticisms, which I think can be answered. But again, Barney will correct me, but I don't think that your typical American congressman pays a great deal of attention to Wolfgang Schäuble or the Brazilian finance minister.
In fact, it's the other way around. I mean, if you look at the where the criticism is coming from of the Fed, this comes from people who do not want them to pay that much attention to international activity. Remember, when the IMF and the ECB were intervening in the European crisis early on in ways that we thought were very helpful when the Fed was doing its currency swap, many of the people who were most critical of quantitative easing were denouncing that, and a bill actually passed the Senate saying we would cut off our IMF contributions if they didn't stop trying to deal with the situation in Europe. So, in fact, none of the people being critical of the Fed domestically on this side of quantitative easing they would want to dissociate themselves. The notion that the Fed is being unfair to foreigners.
these are people who,
they don't want to choose between the Fed and foreigners. They're playing on both their houses.
Yeah. John Taylor.
Just a couple of things. This theory that it's the dual mandate that's causing partisanship, I don't see it that way. I mean, the legislation that's in the table now, on the table, it doesn't have that. It has, for example, the Fed should report its strategy for setting the interest rate. It's sort of trying to get at some of these issues in a more direct way. And to the extent that the dual mandate comes up, it's almost always in the case that it's worse for unemployment, you know, in a way. Well, the efforts,
they're against it.
The efforts that have been, if you look at history, the times the Fed has specifically focused on unemployment, it's actually turned out to be counterproductive. So I think that's what people are thinking about, but they're not. There's not part of legislation, not part of the issue now. I think on quantitative easing, there's a great deal of disagreement about its impact, whether it's been successful. Some people are worried about inflation. Some people are worried about it being a drag on the economy. The evidence is not very clear-cut that it's been beneficial. So I think it's somewhat more complicated, and the actions that I see on the Hill are, they are, I think, addressed, as you say, to different views about how policy should work, how centralized it should be, but it's not simply boiled down to the
Are you troubled at all by how partisan the debate is on the Hill?
I've never seen it this partisan.
It's never been.
I've testified in your committee in the past. I've testified in this committee of this current chairmanship. One side of the aisle is completely supportive of the Fed. The other completely against what the Fed's doing. Again, I have never seen it this way.
I don't think it's good. Is that a concern? Why is it not good?
In many respects, these issues are kind of arcane. They don't lend themselves to different political philosophies. Democrats can agree in certain cases, and Republicans disagree. So I don't think it's good for the institution to have it be so. It can flip. Attitudes can flip. I think it's in a very important institution. Its independence is important. And if it gets dragged into political partisanship, it's not...
Why monitor monetary policy then, John?
Sorry?
Why the demand for the audit to extend to the way monetary policy is formulated? What's that based on? To actually talk to these guys and sort of influence how they set monetary policy. What's that connected to?
I think it's what... Peter referred to this morning. It's just a sense that they don't know what the Fed is doing. They want to know. I'm not arguing that should be the way to go.
Excuse me, but I think the problem is that they do know what the Fed is doing and don't like it. I don't see how you can plausibly argue that this is based on their not knowing what the Fed is doing. They've been very explicit about the quantitative easing, and they don't like it. I mean, I understand part of your argument, but let me say, I think the clincher for me is that this demand to audit monetary policy, i.e. they don't like the monetary policy, the quantitative easing. The other thing I would say is, I understand that some of the legislation doesn't talk specifically about the dual mandate. I will tell you, having been there, that's what they talk about among themselves. And to me, Ed Royce, who is very high up there, actually filed the bill. I believe they have quite sensibly pulled back a little macro-prudential strategy here. I don't get to use that word since I left, so I don't mean it. But it's not just a question of the dual mandate. We're talking about a group of people who are particularly, and there is a House-Senate difference, who very much believe that the federal government is much too deeply involved in virtually every aspect of our lives, that it's a threat to freedom, and the Federal Reserve being as active in it as it is a part of that. And the dual mandate is part of that, that a properly behaved central bank only worries because an inflation only is a much more minimalist thing. So I'm not trying to denigrate people. They believe this very deeply philosophically. I disagree. But again, I don't know how that it's just they don't. The demand for auditing monetary policy has nothing to do with not knowing what they're doing. It is, in fact, fueled by disagreement with what they know they are doing.
John, do you have a view on the audit the Fed bill?
I prefer if they do this strategy policy, report the strategy of the Fed. Ben says they're...
For or against the bill, John?
They're say again, sorry?
Are you for or against the bill? People just ask me that all the time. I get to ask other people.
I'm not in favor. I'm not in favor of it. I'm in favor of an alternative.
So you're against the bill?
I'm in favor of an alternative, yes. I don't.
You're in the wrong profession. We should swap. I'll go be an economist.
Vote for me.
Peter Hooper here.
Charlie Plasser made the point earlier that people don't people hate the Fed, but not Federal Reserve banks, because they're out talking to the public, schmoozing, et cetera. Could the leadership do a better job of schmoozing on Congress, or are the polemics so severe that that's not going to do any good?
Two things. First, and people like Charlie do a very good job, and Eric Welchengren in Boston does, but I think you exaggerate that a little bit. The average citizen, there's a very small number of people who differentiate between the regional bank and the institution. And they do it because the regional banks provide services that are very important. I don't say these are entirely legitimate, but conferences and involvements and, they're trying to do the local focus. We are talking about such profound philosophical differences now that nobody can talk anybody out of anything. I mean, this is not what's going to happen. But I don't think it's that the people at the local level are more charming than Ben or Janet. Part of it is that they are institutions. They do conferences. They provide help. I mean, there's a legitimate service function that the regional banks can do, which makes people happier. But even with that, I do not think anybody in my 32 years ever said to me, that Boston Fed, they're doing a hell of a job.
In the back, there's two people in the back there. Yeah. We'll get all three of you back there.
Thank you. I think a question for Congressman Frank. Mark Spindell from Potomac River Capital. Some of the most outspoken and biting criticism of the Fed lately has come from Democratic senators, including your own Senator Warren, Senator Brown, particularly with respect to leaks, regulatory capture, lingering opacity at the New York Fed. Since Senator Warren and company would seem to line up nicely with your politics, Congressman Frank, just wondering, what do you make of her concerns? She characterized the difference in perspective of President Dudley versus the cop on the beat or the fire warden. And wouldn't their concerns suggest that Senator Shelby might have some traction at increasing transparency on non-monetary policy issues?
No, for the first place, because I think there is pretty complete legal requirement for transparency on non-monetary issues. Again, and we responded. We look at the complaints. One complaint was, these guys are making deals with their friends. They're helping out this group and that group. They shooted Hank Paulson as well. Or why they paid Goldman too much and they paid these debts and not the others. Every single transaction that the Fed has with a private party will at some point be made public with a time lag to insulate it against having sort of market impacts. As to the specific criticisms of Elizabeth Warren, I did think Bill Dudley made a very poor choice of words. I advise people against metaphors, and they get you in trouble. And I think that was one of them. And there was, I have to say, a troubling that business with the woman who got fired was troubling to me. And so I was bothered by that. As to the more systemic criticisms, I do not spend my day-to-day time looking at. Look, I'm a great supporter and fan of Elizabeth Warren. I do not think we should bring Glass-Steagall back, which, for example, she does, although she does acknowledge that it was not the cause of the crisis. So I have some differences with Elizabeth Warren on some of those things. I thought the firing of what's her name, Carmen Segarra, was unfortunate. Beyond that, I haven't followed it closely enough to make a more systemic judgment.
Okay, why don't you pass the mic to the gentleman on your right and then to the left.
J.W. Verrett at the House Financial Services Committee, and I work on the Federal Reserve issues for the committee. I just want to ask the panel, in the discussion about the role of Congress in overseeing the Fed and the role of the legislation that has been proposed, and I appreciate the discussion that's going on differentiating between the legislation that Mr. Huizenga introduced, the rule-based policy bill, and the audit of the Fed legislation that was introduced by someone not on the currently on the committee. Hasn't there been at least some, as the debate has focused on talking points, hasn't there been some lack of recognition about the fact that traditionally threats to independence have always been understood as originating from the executive branch, not the legislative branch. When Larry Summers' original paper with Alicina, he talks about the executive branch, and he defines independence in originating that empirical literature as independence from the executive branch. All the great stories about threats to Fed independence from the past have come from stories about interactions between the Fed chairman and the president. And I know folks are all familiar with them. The Great Treasury Fed Accord, 1951, about the Treasury Department and the Fed. Isn't there at least some willingness to accept the fact that a rule-based policy approach like Professor Taylor talks about, not necessarily the Taylor rule, but a rule requirement, could help to protect the Fed's independence from the executive branch? If there was any coordination going on between those two, wouldn't a rule-based policy requirement help to demonstrate that?
Let me make 2 points. First, I do not oppose a rule-based policy on the grounds that it interferes with the Fed independence. I have never been a great believer in that. Well, I would disagree that the argument has always been the Fed must be independent of the executive, because I spent much of the time in the 80s and 90s being critical of the Fed and being told, shush, that's not your job. I was critical. I thought, in fact, Paul Volcker, with whom I collaborated greatly in our legislation, did remind me that I wasn't always so nice to him. And I had I often differed with Alan Greenspan, and it was treated, you know, go back to the Greenspan era. No, there was no old Congress was not supposed to question him either. Having said that, I don't impugn the legitimacy of those concerns. I just disagree with it about the rule. I'm a little nervous about rules. I got to say, the question came, well, should the Fed have rules for how it's going to respond to a crisis? And it just struck to me, if they knew enough to have good rules about how to respond to the crisis, they could have prevented the crisis. I mean, I don't know how, but the answer is, it is not true that concern about Fed independence was only from the executive branch. It got expressed more because people saw the executive branch as more in a position to influence it. But you go back to the 80s and 90s, which is when I picked up this play, and yeah, congressmen were told, no, you don't get involved. You don't cover, you're not supposed to comment on interest rate decisions because you will be politicizing it. Finally, I have no objection to Congress. My objections to a rule are substantive, not that it's somehow an intrusion on the Fed's prerogative, although I do think, I mean, they overlap in the sense that I think it ties people's hands too much in a situation that requires fluidity.
So, Ben Bernanke, there was two things in that question. One was, is there more risk of political interference from the executive branch, and it's not Congress you worry about? And secondly, if there was legislation that made you define a rule or explain a rule and why you're not following it, what would be so bad with that?
Well, logically, independence means political independence. And there have been times when Congress was exerting undue influence and times when the executive has been exerting undue influence. And I don't think, from the point of view of giving the Fed the independence to take the necessary actions to achieve its mandate, I don't think it makes that much difference. The trouble, I have two objections basically to the FRAT bill. The first is that the presumption that the Taylor rule is the right rule or the right kind of rule, I think, is no longer state-of-the-art thinking. There's an excellent paper by Lars Svensson called What's the Matter with Taylor Rules, where he argues that they are not robust responses in complex situations. The Fed has a rule. The Fed's rule is that we will go for a 2% inflation rate. We will go for the natural rate of unemployment. We put equal weight on those two things. We will give you information about our projection, our interest rates. That is a rule, and that is a framework that should clarify exactly what the Fed's doing. My second objection to the bill is I think that while in principle, yes, you know, it's about the Fed setting its own rule, I think that in practice that it would be used to some extent to constrain policy in ways that would not be correct given the particular exigencies of the moment. So any rule is going to be a problem when the circumstances change in a way that the rule didn't contemplate. And if the Fed is always taking actions like that and Congress is pushing back and saying, no, you're violating the rule, I think that is less directly than audit the Fed, but I think it still is a way in which Congress would exert undue influence on monetary policy.
I just make one important distinction to make, and I know you didn't mean to overstate this, but we say no coordination, we don't want Treasury and the Fed working closely together. Here's part of the problem. We do in regulation. I mean, I am eternally admire Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson for the extent to which, and then Geithner as well, they worked together. And there were no turf battles and things, you know, in 2008 and on into 2009. And I do, there is this problem. Yes, you don't want the executive being as directly involved in the formation of monetary policy. But they have to work closely with the Fed in terms of regulatory, macroprudential, financial stability. And there is tension there that I think you just have to be aware of.
Despite your admonition about metaphors, Stan Fisher's comment on that at an IMF conference was that anybody who thinks you can't be independent in one thing and not independent in another has never been married. Last question, the gentleman in the back there.
Well, fortunately, that no longer applies to me.
And we're glad of it.
Christopher Goins, the American Spectator. Mr. Bernanke, I just wanted to know, if the Fed raises interest rates in the latter part of this year, do you think that the economy will go into recession?
Not going to comment on monetary policy.
Okay. Nice try, though. I'm afraid we have to end it here. I really appreciate everybody coming, despite the weather, and I want you to join me in thanking not only these panelists, but the previous ones.